Okay, everybody should be now at slide number one. If you're moving off the seminar homepage, you should have clicked join the seminar. I'd like to welcome to today's Cluin Internet Seminar, CARE Project Officers Training, sponsored by the CARE National Program. I'm Mike Adam, and I'll be moderating today's session. Today's session will have materials mentioned that you can find under the links from the seminar homepage that you were just on, or additionally through the additional resources link that you can find that we have conveniently provided for you on the last slide of today's presentation, slide 89. We have a long list of instructors for today's seminar. Their contact information is listed on slide 1. More information about them can also be found on the seminar homepage. A link to today's detailed agenda is also available on the seminar homepage. Moving on to slide 2, we have some logistical and navigational information. Please mute your phone lines during the seminar to minimize disruption and background noise. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, please use star 6 mute. And pound 6 will unmute you're directed during the presentation to unmute your phone. Please do not put this call on hold. As many times, some systems have background music over the mute line, and that could disrupt the seminar. Please also note that we may globally mute the phone lines if there is excessive background noise. At the time, at a particular time when it's time to speak, we'll instruct you on how to unmute your phone if the phones do get globally muted. We will be taking questions during the Q&A sessions via online text. You can access this feature by clicking the question mark icon at the top of the screen. Type in your contact info and your question will be submitted to the moderator. You can submit questions at any time during the presentation, and the moderator will present your questions during the Q&A sessions. You can move forward or backward in the slides by using the single arrow buttons at the top of the screen. The double arrow buttons will take you to the first and last slides, respectively. You may also advance to any slide using the numbered links that appear on the left side of your screen. The button with the house icon will take you back to the main seminar page, which has the agenda, speaker information, and list slides and additional resources that I had mentioned before. The button with a computer disk can be used to download and save today's presentation material. Just a note that we are recording this, and the archive will be available at the link shown on slide 2. Once again, I please remind you to please mute your phone. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, you may hit star 6. And with that, I'll turn the things over turn the training over to the CARE program. Gail?
Actually, Stacy, would you like to do the roll call before I begin?
Okay, sure. Welcome, everyone, and we just want to take a few minutes just to see who all we have on the line with us today. And actually, we will start from Region 1. I'm Stacy Johnson-Pridgen, CARE Regional Coordinator, and with me is?
Havana Chiavuaji Jr. I work with Stacy, and I'm going to be the new PO for the Worcester Regional Environmental Council.
All right. Welcome, Quibena. Do we have anyone on the line from Region 2?
Yes, this is Charles Hayward.
Welcome, Charles. And is there someone else?
Mary Beth Smuts here, Region 1.
Oh, Mary Beth, hi, how are you? You were supposed to join us. I'm sorry.
I have some time.
Okay, excellent. Thanks. Anyone else from Region 2?
Okay. Bob Kelly, our programs branch.
Great. Welcome, Bob. Anyone else? Okay, Region 3. Do we have anyone on the line?
Yes. Good afternoon. Tiana Blunt.
Hi, Tiana.
Hi, and this is Erin Sullivan.
Welcome, Erin. Region 4. Anyone from Region 5? Region 6?
We know Sharon is on the line. She's just having a little technical difficulty that they're fixing right now.
Okay.
And Maggie has told me she will be joining us shortly.
Okay, great. Region 7?
This is Kathleen Fenton from Kansas City, Region 7, and I have a crowd here, so I'm going to have them introduce themselves.
Okay, great.
Peggy Vaughn.
Jeanette Schaefer.
Gina Greer.
Jennifer Ousley. Pamela Houston.
That's all of us in Region 7.
Okay, excellent. Welcome, Region 7. Anyone from Region 8? Region 9?
Diane Woods.
Diane.
We've noticed that Zoe is on the line, but she's doing it electronically from her desk, so she's not using a phone.
Okay.
No, just wanted to let you know that we had a message from Zoe.
Great, thanks.
Right, anyone from Region 10?
Sally Hamst.
Renee Doxat.
Davis Zen.
Great. Thank you all. I'm going to turn it back over to headquarters.
Okay, we have, I'm sorry, this is Mike, moderator. We did have Debbie Lowe ask a question. How do we do roll call if we're getting audio via web only?
Well, she just did it by sending the email, so we know she's on. And April also is saying that she's on, so that's good. April from Region 8.
So I guess if there's anyone else who's streaming, they could just submit a question and let us know they're on.
Right.
And would the rest of you from headquarters who are on the line, if you would just introduce yourself?
This is Gail Bonanno, the Office of Water Co-Chair for CARE. Marva King, the Office of Air and Radiation Co-Chair for CARE. Remington Jackson and Catrice Jefferson are here in the room.
And Katie Callan will be joining us shortly.
And this is Michelle Mangioli on the line.
Oh, hi, Michelle.
Hey, guys.
And Keisha Holliday. I'm from OGD. I'm the compliance officer.
Oh, great. Hi, Keisha.
Hi.
Anyone else on the line that we heard from yet? Great. Again, welcome, and I'll turn it back over to Patrice.
Okay, we can get started now, so we'll turn it over to Gail now.
Okay. First, I want to ask, can everyone hear okay? I know there were some problems a little earlier.
Yes.
Okay, great. I moved it as close as I can get. I'm down for the welcome, and the first thing I want to do is to thank you all our new project officers, our new regional coordinators, all of our returning folks, and a special thanks to Stacy and the rest of our Region 1 CARE folks for putting together this wonderful training with the help of Catrice. I'm really sorry that I can't get to meet all of the new folks in person, and I know Marva and others feel the same way. The reason that we're doing this training by webinar is that I'm sure many of you know by now the agency cut its travel budget, and there are also restrictions now on internal meetings and how many folks we can send. So this is our first project officer training by webinar. As you're going through, if you have any comments or suggestions, make a note of those. There will be a time at the end of today and then at the end of the 30th so that we can make any adjustments that are needed. You know, my boss always tells me, you're so passionate about CARE. You know, CARE, you all, I are joining, as I've heard others say, the premier community-based program in EPA. It is, I think you'll see, it's a wonderful experience, but it's also a lot of hard work, and we recognize that, and we appreciate it here at headquarters and in the regions, too. I'm going to talk a little bit about the national perspective of the CARE program, about the program as a whole. CARE started in 2005. It is now, 6 years later, highly visible within EPA, highly successful at combining the agency's expertise with the community's capacity building in order to achieve local improvements in the local environment. And that's really key. How we got here and why we launched this program in 2005, we had there were a couple of reports that came out that talked about the need to do multimedia work, you know, look across the agency, folks needed to work better together. And then at the NEJAC meetings, the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Mm-hmm. I always get a council. EPA senior managers were going to those meetings, and they were, you know, talking about their successes, and they had reduced air pollution or they had reduced water pollution. And the community said, well, that's great, but what are you doing for me? What are you doing in my community? And folks came back from those meetings and looked at the report, looked at the various community programs that were in existence in the agency at that time, including the Environmental Justice Grant Program, and there were some others. And they said, you know, one of the most successful programs that the communities always tout as understanding them better is the Superfund program. So what made the Superfund program different from the others? It was that they had somebody in the community. And, you know, that is really the beauty of what you're going to be able to do. You are going to have direct access and direct contact and work with the community. You're going to be a partner. And that was the first important part of CARE. And then the next was, well, we're air, water, waste, you know, we're all on our stovepipes, nobody talks to anybody else, we're out in the communities, we annoy them because they have to talk to all these different people, we don't get them. So we'll have the one person in the community, our project officers, and we're going to take a holistic look the way the communities look at their environment, and it's multimedia. You know, you all, in particular, our new project officers and our project officers, are really what makes CARE the success that it is. It's a very important and critical role that you all perform for us. You know, you're able to create these local partnerships that leverage resources and sustain the great work of the community. You deliver EPA tools and technical assistance. You help the community solve problems, find information, and get them assistance. And the most important thing that you do is improve the local environment. And communities really appreciate it. You're able to do this because the other aspect of CARE, not only is it multimedia, but it's not, we call it a grant program, but it's really cooperative agreements. So that gives you a seat at the table. It makes you a partner with the community. We're not just throwing money at the community. We're actually a partner with them as they go through the CARE process. And, you know, I talked about how CARE is visible. Marva and I and others can attest to how visible the program is. Marva's laughing. It has a lot of visibility within EPA and also within the administration. As I said, we are really the premier community-based program because we give money directly to the communities. We're partners with the communities, and they decide their priorities. And this was confirmed by a National Academy of Public Administration report in May of 2009. And for those of you who don't know, it's a very well-respected group who does evaluations. And they found that CARE is a model that works. And now within the agency, there is a recognition that, hey, there's this CARE model, which Marv is going to talk more about, that works to combine the agency's assistance and experience with the community's capacity building. So I'm going to give you very briefly what have we done in the CARE program between 2005 and 2009. Our communities have leveraged dollar for dollar, basically. We've given, we gave about $14.5 million in grants, and they leveraged $14 million through 2009. They engaged 1,700 partners. They visited over 4,000 homes to provide information or testing. And they also provided information to another 3,000 businesses and 50,000 individuals. And they've engaged schools and youth. So not only are we visible, but we're producing results. So very quickly, how do we get the work done? Well, we have, we're what's called a matrix organization. And we're organized by, we have a CARE executive team, which provides guidance and policy direction. We have a CARE administrative team that Marva and I co-chair, with a number of teams that support the administrative team and the executive team. We have outreach, tracking, measures, grants, and then community training. And then we also have a very large regional component on the other side of the national. And there we have our CARE regional coordination team. And Mike Sandrowski co-chairs that with Sally Hampton and Kathleen Fenton, who are both on the phone. And there are a number of regional teams there that you're going to hear about. So the other thing is some of you are new, like the regional coordinators to the program, because the leadership of the CARE program itself here at headquarters rotates amongst the four media programs. So right now the Office of Water is the lead. In 2013, the Office of Air will become the lead. So this is a lot. You're going to hear a lot of information over the course of the next 7 hours, I guess, total. But I want you to, I don't want you to feel overwhelmed. I want you to know that the regional coordinators are an excellent resource, and we're all here for you. If you have questions or you need something, feel free to contact any one of us. And with that, I will turn it over to Marva.
Thanks, Gail. That was a very informative welcome, and it's a lot of stuff.
I was asked.
Yeah. No, it's good. I mean, I'm saying it's good. It's very informative. It's very good. And we do have that PowerPoint presentation available that we give to various people around headquarters. We can send that out later if you want. I think we have it also on ESC, Environmental Science Connector. So, and I'm sure some of your regional coordinators have that as well, because we've already shared that type of information with them. And so again, I will add to the welcome. Welcome. We're glad you're here. We're glad you're a part of us. I do want to make Stacey aware that James Sullivan is streaming in from Region 2. He's another one who is not verbally on the phone, but he's streaming in. So you would have that for your record, Stacey. And so my role is to, and I got to hurry up because Kathleen has to start at 12:30. I got your back, Kathleen, on this. My role is to talk about various interconnections between the CARE, what the CARE program does, and the roadmap and PACH. If you switched over to my presentation, it has my name on it. And it's called CARE Roadmap and PACH. and we'll go to the first slide of that afterwards. And you've seen this before. We put it everywhere, the four-step care process. And this is basically what care is about, right? We build a partnership. We identify problems and solutions. We take action. We build sustainability. And what I want to do is show you how these two tools, the care roadmap and PACEH, help a community do that. And so next slide, Remy. And my next slide says, how can this be accomplished? And so what we do is we say that we will not prescribe a single method or model for anyone to use. We tell our applicants they can use their logical framework, any framework they want to. They can call it whatever they want as long as they describe a framework in their application. What we did is the reason why we highlight the roadmap and PACEH is because early on in the care program, we had a lot of applicants saying, but do you have an example? And so where the roadmap came out of is that National Environmental Justice Advisory Council that Gail mentioned, that developed out of that council, and we fine-tuned it with a small group of care folks and these council folks, and pull together a logical step for communities. Where PACEH comes from is the Centers for Disease Control. So it's a protocol for assessing communities' excellence in environmental health. The links are there if you want to look at them later. But basically, we have a lot of our care applications who are from local government who uses the PACEH. And I just want to show you really quickly how they're very similar. Okay, next slide. And so the care roadmap has 10 major steps, and they're described there. And it's a logical step through for a community to start building a partnership, identifying their concerns, their risks, collecting the information, ranking their stuff, and starting to identify solutions. Next slide, please. PACEH has more steps than care roadmap, but it correlates, as I was saying. There are 13 tasks of the PACEH, and they do the same thing. It's just a different type of logical step. That's why we're saying any applicant can use any process, and they can call it the Marva King process for all we care, as long as it is a logical step. Next slide, please. So the next slide shows the 13 tasks of the PACEH model, and it seems like a lot. But some communities need that additional information more than the 10 steps of the roadmap. That's why we actually tell them in some of our debriefs to look oral debriefs, because Patrice and I do those for people who do not get the care funding. We tell them, look at these models. They'll help you understand what we're trying to do in the care program. Next slide talks about I'm starting to compare now key objectives of the care roadmap and PACEH. So as you can see, without me having to read them, that they're very similar, right? There's four bullets on each side, and they're basically saying the same thing. Some of the wording is a little different. The next slide after that, which is at this point, I believe, slide 8, it says, again, I start talking about the steps. The steps in the care roadmap and the steps in the PACEH. I'm just letting you see how they're very similar and how your community can use either of these logical processes to work their stuff through their level one work plan. Next slide, please. The next slide talks about the rest of the steps, steps 6 through 10 roadmap, and 7 through 13 in PACEH. Just so you can see, so you don't have to go read both of them at the same time, right now, you can just see on these slides how they are very similar. Just different wording, but they mean the same thing. This slide, I just wanted to show you in a nutshell what it looks like. I put the PACEH stuff on top of the care roadmap. So you can see, even though I've been telling you on the other slides, you can see how they're very similar, how they hook up exactly with the roadmap, how PACE hooks up with that. Okay, next slide, please. And so this is my final slide, and I made it on time. This is my final slide, and it just and all I wanted to tell you was that these are examples of tools your community grant recipient can use. You know, they don't have to use them, but sometimes people need some type of pathway to where they want to go. And so this can help them get there. The steps are simultaneous, and they're iterative, and which means that they don't have to do step one and then step two and step three. They can actually do step one and then go over to step four or whatever. It's up to them. It's up to that community. It's a cooperative agreement, yes, and we're there to guide them, yes, but it's also up to them because it's their money, their work plan, their project, their community. We're there to help them get down that path. And what is the ultimate goal, right? The ultimate goal is to create a more healthy community. And the process, both processes are designed to achieve consensus and facilitate a solution. And so that's it. Kathleen, I made it right on time for you.
Thank you, ma'am. I have the ability to move my slide, so is that okay? Does that work for the facilitator?
Right. Yes, you can move your slide, and she'll just keep up with us as you're moving.
Okay,
that's
great.
Fine.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Kathleen Fenton. I reside in Kansas City at the Region 7 office, and I'm a regional coordinator and a project officer, and I've had the honor to do that. I've been in quite a few communities here in Region 7, and it's the best job you'll ever have, I'll say that. You become a magnet in the community and a catalyst, and it's you're basically the foundation of the program. You've heard that already before, but truly the project officers make this program what it is. They're the heart and soul of the program. So with that, I just want to give you an idea of what to expect, and I'm going to jam as much of this information in as possible, but leave as much time as possible for questions, because I think you'll have them. And I am not the all-knowing on this, and I'm hoping that anyone that served as a project officer or is a regional coordinator or anyone in headquarters can also help answer any questions that occur. So with that, I'm going to just get going. Okay, I've got to hit the right button. Okay, I love this slide because it really shows all of the different aspects of what may happen as you are a project officer. The speed limit is at about 50 and you're going 167. You will have successes and failures, and you will have some oopses. And it's all part of working in communities. You do not have a crystal ball, even though you're expected to. And so things like this will happen. And just know that this truly is a family of folks that will help you get through your CARE 2-year stint. And if you're lucky, you get a 4-year stint. We actually have a CARE Level 1 and a CARE Level 2. If you have not yet read the RFP, that would be a really great starting point for folks to really get into what CARE is all about. CARE Level 1, I'll go into much more detail about what it expects, but it is the foundational part of working in a community, building a partnership, identifying what's going on in a community regarding its environmental concerns, educating the community, and then delivering a prioritized list of what their concerns are. Level 2, Level 1 is up to $100,000. The Level 2 project is up to $300,000, and that funding, what the deliverables are for that is that you move forward your partnership. The grantee moves that partnership in that local community forward and starts identifying, if they haven't already in Level 1, identifying local solutions and working on what those implementation steps are for those local solutions. So that's kind of an add-on of what CARE is all about, and that's what you'll be walking into, whether or not you're a Level 1 or a Level 2 project officer. We'll go over what the roles are, what to expect, and a little bit about negotiating the care cooperative agreement today. I already stated that those items that Marva already went through are great items to go through if you are not familiar with care. Read the RFP. Probably the best information to know is to listen when you're in a community. Pitch in and ask what you can do to help to forward the work plan forward. And celebrate your small successes, because sometimes they're hard to find, and it really helps the community understand why you're there if they understand that you're there for the long haul and you're going to be there to help celebrate as well. Help your grantee through the care roadmap. You're basically their eyes and ears and mentor on getting through the care roadmap or the PACE-EH program. Or what I always say is your work plan is your Bible. That's what you have to abide by. That's what your grantee has to abide by. And that's what why negotiating it is so important. So familiarize yourself with your community and how it works. Walk around, check out the restaurants, check out, what some of the mores are and what folks, even how folks talk and what some of the slang is. It's really important to understand who your community is. Check out the city or the community or the nonprofit website. Understand who you're talking to. If you're talking with a grantee, see if there are folks in the community that you might have a chance to talk with, go have coffee with, that are maybe unspoken leaders in the community, untitled leaders, but leaders just the same. You'll be one of the perceived experts in the meeting room. So know what's going on and know what the politics are, know how the politics run, what their informal and formal political structures are. What they do for fun and where to find a good food. That's always a great icebreaker, to find out where a good restaurant is. Tread lightly when you first start working with a new community. Be a keen observer. Observe reactions. Understand who has credibility and respect in the community. And ask respectfully a lot of questions. Learn about your community's culture. I've talked about that already. The formal protocols, their dress, their sense of time. Review the roles and responsibilities summary sheet that will be part of the additional documents that will be a part of this session. Know what your role is and what your regional coordinator's role is. And the terms and conditions document, it's another document that will be part of this seminar too. And we also have how to negotiate a work plan document. All of those documents are going to be incredibly helpful for your grant and your cooperative agreement. I would say that going through literally line by line your terms and conditions with your grantee will be a very good thing for both of you. So note that as a checklist item to add to your list of to-dos. Read the RFP and understand the final work plan. Sometimes you may or may not be the one negotiating the work plan. If you're not, curl up with a good beverage and read that work plan a couple of times, because that's what you'll have to abide by. What is committed to in that work plan is basically, in stone. How you do it is negotiable. What you do is not negotiable. So those are good kind of words to live by. I keep hitting the wrong button. Okay. Travel to your site as often as possible. Find your regional technical help and state and local partners and other available resources to help sustain the grantees care partnership. Help your partnership connect the dots. I use that term a lot. To risk reduction, help them find good measures for their work, sustainability resources, and EPA technical help. You're basically the conduit for all of the technical help within the region, and sometimes other federal agencies and other state and local agencies. Sometimes you're going to be the front person asking for help, but hopefully your grantee is also with you by your side trying to gain those partnerships for the work itself. provide EPA, you will be helping the grantee by providing EPA voluntary program tools and expertise. And Martha Barber, who is one of our POs in Alaska, she's created a post-award handout that will also be part of the document. It will help help your grantee and yourself detail the commitments through action and documentation. So that's another document to refer to. Help them understand what the quarterly report is. Michelle Mandolia will be talking about that a little bit later. And what the measurement matrix is, another reporting document that we require in the terms and conditions. Help them, you'll have to walk through that with them, and you're going to be the point person for who they will be sending that to most likely, or to their regional coordinator. But the content in that document is going to be really important for the program itself, so that we can tell Congress how beneficial this program is, so that we can tell our other partners, so that we can hopefully team with other programs within the region and outside the region, because we're getting it done. So documentation of this program is really important. I can't stress that enough. And how you work with your grantee to document the progress of their work is really important. Look over the CARE Sustainability Checklist. That's another handout that you'll be given as well. There's one, there's aspects of it that apply to both Level 1 and Level 2. And work with your grantee at the very beginning to address action items that are suggested on that checklist. Review the CARE measurements and tips sheet and use it when creating your CARE work plan. Identify and help address gaps and concerns. If the entire community is not involved, how can you get them involved? What type of education might work best? How should information be presented? Give them suggestions if they're struggling with how to do presentations within their community. If you don't know, talk to some of the leaders in the community about how best to present to their community. What partners are not at the table? How can their processes be improved? How will they make decisions? That's a big one. As they are engaging the community as a whole, how they make decisions and come to consensus is really important. So finding out ahead of time how those decisions will be made, what that process will be, is nice to get in line and upfront and agreed to first. Is the spoken or written language being used, is what is being used a barrier for the members of the community? Are there other ways of getting the information to the community, word of mouth, flyers, commercials that are on their cable access? There's various ways. And we'll talk about that too. Tiana's going to talk about that, using communication systems and how best to get to your community. Okay, bring experts in, other CARE grantees. That's one of the kind of fascinating things about this program is that some of the other grantees are more than happy to help you out or help your grantee out. So if it's in another region, we'll work with the regional coordinator and help your grantee through someone that's already been through it before. Talk to folks at headquarters that can help you. Talk to other regional coordinators or other POs in other regions. These partners are very helpful. I get on the phone, I can't tell you how many times when I'm suffering, a lapse in memory of what to do next or where to go for a particular resource. So use folks that are within the EPA family as well. Meet with your CARE regional coordinator and talk CARE shop often. It's amazing how much you can understand by just sitting down and talking with your regional coordinator. Some of the regional coordinators are new, and they also know that they can get on the phone with any other regional coordinator that's been around the block and help you through anything. This work can be very challenging and difficult and confusing and rewarding all at once, all wrapped up together. And know that there are lots of folks around to help you through it. know that the project most likely will be audited. So help your grantee work, document, and deliver work products as if an audit is certain. CARE is under a lot of scrutiny right now because it is a fairly new program, and it's not a ton of money, but it's enough money that folks are wanting to make sure that the money is being used appropriately. So work with that in mind. You don't have to do this work by yourself. I've said that numerous times already. There's a themes document that's going to be part of the cadre of documents that you can go through. And that themes document talks about what different project officers have worked on different issues, different themes, different categories of issues, and know that they are there to help you if your grantee is going through the same particular project or theme or category of work. Find a CARE mentor. I think I'm going to have to refer to Stacy on this. I think we may have some folks that are getting mentors today if you're a brand new CARE PO. So if you're not, if that isn't happening, try and find one, and we can definitely work through that later if need be. Participate on the CARE Project Officer call. There will be a calendar for those Project Officer calls. They are random issue-based calls that project officers are going through, and we host them monthly. So look at that calendar. Meet often with your grantee through face-to-face meetings or conference calls. Know that we have 800 numbers for those conference calls so they can call in and save a dime. We truly recommend that if necessary, and not all grantees need this kind of help, but if necessary, get on a conference call with them at least monthly and possibly even weekly if that's needed. So that's the kind of TLC that we give our grantees if in fact they need it. Your work plan, the CARE RFP, and the CARE website, and your CARE mentors are your helpmates and your guideposts, so don't forget to use them. Ask for help if you need to. Don't be surprised if you need help. It most likely will happen somewhere along the way. Your job is to know how to proceed through the CARE roadmap. Help your grantee define and implement how they will proceed. Understand and be able to explain the need for a defined decision-making process. I went over that a little bit already. And I just want to go back to the how message. Your work plan lays out the best guesstimate of the content of what they're going to do. How they are going to do it is always a bit in flux. So to give you an example, let's say that they are going to engage the community. That doesn't change. They still have to engage the community, but how they engage the community, let's say they decide to go to do Twitters because that works in their community versus flyers or knocking on doors. How they do it is changeable. What they do is not changeable. What will their ranking and prioritization process for understanding their identified environmental concerns, what will that ranking and prioritization process look like? How will they do it? These questions will come up often, and Margaret Millard is going to be discussing that particular element of the CARE roadmap. So understanding how they're going to do that is really important. Should the grantee use a neutral facilitator during the meeting? If they choose to do that and work with a neutral facilitator so that they actually can, have an even more neutral role in the community as the grantee, then you need to make sure that that's part of your work plan and that it's part of your budget. So those are things that you might need to consider as a project officer as you're negotiating a work plan. Help your grantee, or let me back up too. You may find out later that you don't have that ability in your work plan and you need it. So there's opportunities for possibly getting some help regarding task. There's some opportunities for CARE project officers to tap some other resources, and know that there are those opportunities to help out your grantee if, in fact, it wasn't planned for. Help your grantee understand how to best keep their volunteers. That's huge. Meeting fatigue happens during care processes at times, and understanding how to motivate volunteers so that they keep coming back. You want the community engaged, and getting somehow two volunteers to get to the community itself is going to be a huge helpmate. So understanding how to keep them is a really good question to ask your grantee. There most likely will be political barriers, so help clear them. And sometimes those can be incredibly, incredibly difficult, and that may be where you get on the phone with headquarters. It may be where you get on the you go talk to your lawyers in your region. It may be where you talk to folks that are mediators in your region. So know that that can be an issue that comes up. Help the grantee understand how information can be collected without a survey, right, Marva? It's kind of a running joke because we ask folks to, in level one, to gather quite a bit of information, but we cannot pay for surveys. So how do they get that done? And that can be a question later, but I just wanted to flag that as an issue that comes up often. Make sure that your grantee understands their budget and their terms and conditions. This cooperative agreement is a legally binding contract. I'm using contract loosely. It's a cooperative agreement, but it's almost as if like it is a contract. Refer to the sustainability checklist with your grantee throughout the two-year grant period. Determine what the grantee can do to ensure long-term changes. One of the ultimate goals when we walk away after the 4 years at level one and level two is that the work can continue. Hopefully some type of community involvement can also continue, that there's some, whether it be an informal structure or a true structure like a 501c3 that is established. We really hope that there is sustainability tethers to the work that has been done for the last 4 years. Your job is to know how to proceed through your grantee's work plan, help your grantee define and implement how they will proceed. Find out what EPA resources your grantee can access to deliver risk reduction and sustainability and sustainable local solutions and partnerships. Your grantee is going to be oftentimes very well connected to their own community, and they may have additional in-kind resources that they can tap. So make sure you're asking those questions. What other resources can they tap to help them get through this work? And I'm sorry, I've morphed into level two project officer tips, so I didn't make that flag known.
Hey, Kathleen?
Yes.
Can you please make sure to call out what slide you're on? There's a couple of folks that are having a hard time figuring that out.
Oh, I bet. You bet. Right now I'm on, in fact, I don't have them numbered, so. Slide 36. Thank you. I'll just wait 1 second so folks can get through. At the top it says Care Level 2 Project Officer Tips, slide 36. Find out what other Level 2 grants have been in the past and are similar to yours. Meet with them to reap their knowledge and experience. That is something I've talked about already. It's really helpful to see what other folks have gone through and some of the ideas that they've exchanged. It's been very helpful for me in the past. We've already talked about the sustainability checklist. Review, edit, improve, document, and broadcast your measures of success. So when you're negotiating your work plan right now, some of you are in the midst of that. If they're delivering something, also ask yourself, how are you going to know that they're going to succeed in whatever that output is, whatever that outcome is? Make sure that many of your outcomes have measures. And again, Michelle Mandoli will talk about those in a minute, or I don't know when, on the agenda. She'll talk about those on the agenda sometime in the next 2 days. Where's the number at, Pam?
From 7, bottom right hand, under all.
Oh, little teeny one. Okay. Slide 37. How do we engage and keep our partners throughout a level two? That's huge. We get into local implementation of solutions, and we may have had certain partners in level one. How do we keep them involved in level two? How do we get new partners in level two? What kind of public engagement is necessary at the level two process? Oftentimes we engage the whole community in level one. How do you keep them knowledgeable of how you are closing the circle in level two? That's often a question that comes up. How can POs engage regional headquarters and state experts to help them? It's what I call connecting the dots. And if you are connected within your region, let other folks help you connect the dots. In our region, folks have tethers to the states that I don't have. Other folks in the region have contacts in the states that I don't have. Talk to folks that you know that particular issue, and they may know other experts that can help you out. So you have to be proactive in finding out how to connect the dots for your grantee as far as resources and expertise, technical expertise. That's part of what we give to the grantee is our technical expertise. And if you don't have it, you're the one that needs to help them find it. What happens if there are problems with contractors, subgrantees, politicos, work stoppage, personnel issues? I would say regarding all of those potential problems, the other thing you'll want to know is who your grant specialist is and how to work with them to help you get through those issues. Work with your regional coordinator. You might have to call headquarters and let them know what's going on, because if there is a work stoppage, it may mean that there will need to be a continuation of the grant, that it's not going to end at the September 30th date 2 years later. So if there are issues, flag them as soon as possible to your RC, talk to your RC about it, and work with your lawyer or your grant specialist or other folks that can help you to unwind sometimes a tangled mess that occurs regarding those issues. Okay, I'm going to stop there for questions, and then we'll go into the negotiating a work plan. And I'm not sure how much more time I have, so could someone give me what the time is for the next session? We're breaking at, let's see.
Can you go to, you're supposed to go until 1:45.
Okay. So I can stop for a couple minutes for questions on what I've just spoken about, and then we can go into negotiating a work plan.
Kathleen, we have a question that got typed in, and it's, can the grantee engage a contractor with award money? If yes, does the PO need to be COTR, C-O-T-R?
I'm not familiar with that last term, Gail.
Maggie, I'm kind of familiar.
Officer's technical representative. It's a term used in contracting.
Maggie, go ahead. You can answer it.
So if they're going to, first of all, they have to compete and take bids if they're going to contract with anyone. Usually where I'm involved is they usually do an RFQ or a request for people to submit, you know, in response to their needs. So, for example, in a level one, if they need a technical person, our Gary grant, they wanted to pay someone with expertise to lead the PACE process and to do some technical work on the risk analysis and such, and they had that as a contract person. So they put in the skills, and this is called an RFQ. It's kind of like an RFA for contracts. They gave us the opportunity to review it, so we were involved in the reviewing it, making sure they met all the requirements of our competition, you know, for contracts. But then, no, we don't then serve as the, you know, COTR or the COR, or we don't have any other role after that. We're just ensuring that they're aware of what they have to compete it and what, you know, what standard they have to meet to compete it, and we review their notice for applicants. to ensure it meets our standards. And go ahead.
And I would add one other thing, and that is that if your grantee has a fairly significant contract, the project officer goes to the grantee first. They don't ever call the contractor directly. They should always have the grantee on the phone when talking with the contractor. It's their contractor, it's not our contractor. So your role is to help the grantee at all times. So whenever you're dealing with the contractor, make sure that you're going through the grantee first.
And to give an example, like in Gary, so they were contracting a significant person, a person who was going to lead their meetings and their PACE process, but I always dealt directly with the person who was the city of Gary, Doreen Carey, the person who was the grantee. I never dealt directly with the contract employee. I'd ask the questions to the grantee, you know. So even if it's someone who's, like, leading meetings or has a significant role, you want to make sure you keep that distinction.
Okay, any other questions?
Yes, Kathleen?
Yes.
Yes, there's a question from Debbie Lowe from Region 9, and it says, my grantee wants to assess community knowledge before and after a training via a written form with questions about the environmental topic being taught. Would this be considered a survey?
I would consider that an evaluation form of the meeting, not a survey. Does anyone else have a qualifier on that?
I agree. In some communities, they develop this, and so it's just the same form at every meeting also.
Okay.
So it's like pre and post tests.
Any other questions?
No more written questions. Does anyone have questions on the phone? Okay, Kathleen, you can move forward.
This next part I don't have on a slide, but it is in the document, What to Expect as a Project Officer, that's part of your handout. And I just want to quickly go over what the deliverables are for a Level 1 and a Level 2. A CARE Level 1 deliverable list is a local, so this is what the grantee will need to deliver as part, as through their work plan, and elements of this is what you will have in your work plan. How are they and that they will deliver a local partnership focused on the environment? They will identify the community's concerns. They will educate the community about their concerns. They will rank and prioritize the community's concerns. They will deliver a partnership, a prioritized list of the community's concerns, and possibly some of the local solutions to reduce the risk. And they will work on how the community group can work toward sustaining their efforts. So those are the deliverables for Level 1. And the deliverables for Level 2, keep the local partnership going and growing. Keep the community engaged. Inform the community of the Level 1 results and the Level 2 actions and next steps. Deliver risk reduction actions. Announce your successes through newspaper articles, radio interviews, promising practices, EPA articles. We'll talk about that later. Web stories on your EPA or outside websites. The community should also hold a celebration to showcase their successes. And that can happen in Level 1 as well. And also plan for the sustainability of all of your efforts and actions. So with that, those are the deliverables for both Level 1 and Level 2. And I will go quickly over the negotiating a work plan slide. Slide 38. Again, start with your RFP, your proposal, your roadmap, and your notes. And the advice I give when going through the initial proposal, because that's where you'll start, is to take a highlighter and sit down and write and highlight
the deliverables that they said that they would deliver. Pull out what their project plan is, pull out who's going to do what, pull out what the timing of it is. If those things aren't in there, those are the notes that you put on the work on your proposal to move forward onto a work plan. So take your notes, take the RFP, take your proposal and your roadmap or whatever process they're going to use, PACH, and that's where you'll start. Get the answers to these questions when creating the work plan. How will they implement each task? Who will implement the task? When will they implement the task? The next slide is that 41. Get the answers to these questions when creating the work plan also. How does the budget support the task? How can their partners help with each of those tasks? Syncing the budget and the work plan is really important. So if they're delivering something and it's not in their work plan, in their budget, how are they going to deliver that? Is it all going to be on the shoulders of that particular personnel person? Do they have a budget to do that piece of work? So make sure that the budget is syncing with their work plan. Read your proposal and highlight all of the stated and potential actions. Highlight the areas that you have questions on or where there are gaps. Identify what is going to be accomplished and find out how it will be accomplished during the negotiation. And don't be surprised if your negotiation is more than one sit-down meeting. Speaking from experience, I oftentimes have to go back, you know, maybe two or three times before we have a final work plan. Know that your work plan is a best estimate. Their budget is a best estimate. But there are things that if they change significant portions of their budget, they need to go through their project officer to make changes. So, for instance, I'll give you an example. If they think that they're going to spend $2,000 on getting their message out regarding their meetings, and they only spend $1,000, that's okay. You can reroute that leftover $1,000 somewhere else in the plan, but they still have to deliver, you know, an appropriate way of delivering the message to get the word out about the meeting. So again, it's a best guess, but it can be changed. But all of it should be talked to about and with the project officer if there are changes. If the work plan is not clear to you, gain clarity during the work plan negotiation or at your first face-to-face meeting. And I would say, you know, use it on a regular basis at all of your meetings. Where are you at on the plan? Are you on time? I thought in this quarter you were going to be delivering this. Where are you at on that? So use it as your guidepost during your whole two-year process or your 18-month process. Circulate your proposal and work plan to others in your region for their insight. For instance, in level two, oftentimes there are particular technical experts that can help you with that. I have one this year that's going to have a radon focus, and I'm sending it down to our radon folks to look at, to make sure that there's some, you know, something that I've missed, if they want to add to it, and the grantee's okay with it. Circulate your proposal and work plans to other, I just said that. Does your work plan need a quality assurance plan? Most of them do. There's examples of QAPs on the Environmental Science Connector. You can get copies of them. We have them at your for you to look at. Get to know who your QAPP person is in your region. Learn what the ropes are regarding that. If you don't know, talk to your RC about it. Consider using a logic model to help you and the grantee keep track of where they are at, what is next, and how they are doing, what's the next output that needs to occur, and what's the final outcome, what's the measure going to be. Logic models are great to help guide you on that. If you're not familiar with a logic model, there's tons of examples if you Google it, and there's also examples of them that other CARE grantees have used that we can share with you. Define what the grantee's terms and conditions will be. There is a copy of what Region 7 uses. Every region's a little different, but this particular document, the Terms and Conditions document, is a good baseline for you to look at and to bring to your grant specialist. So go over that, know it. It's a little legalese, but it's really important to understand what those terms and conditions are. Does their budget make sense and does it support the work? I've talked about that already. Make sure all contracts and subgrants are clear and competed if need be. Contracts all have to be competed. However, this is not the legal term of it, but if they are another nonprofit, most of those do not need to be competed, and that is considered a sub-grant. But again, talk to your grant specialist about if they're farming out any of their work, that is that a contract or is that a sub-grant? Does it need to be competed? How do they compete it? Your grant specialist should be able to help you through that process. Work with and befriend your grant specialist. They will help you and understand what can and cannot be done. What slide am I on now? I'm on 46. And are you a certified project officer? It's probably something I should have asked first. You really need to be. There's a online certification program through the grants office that you have to go through. And I think it gets you to a 6-year certification once you complete it. It's very helpful, and it's something that is required. Your PO job after the award: review and finalize and post all CARE outputs from the grant to the IGMS and to the CARE ESC. That's a whole other issue we'll talk about in a bit. Deliver all quarterly reports from your grantee to headquarters on time. Check in often with your grantee. Check with your financial data warehouse regarding the budget usage throughout the grant period and make sure that things look appropriate. If amendments need to occur, make sure they are officially documented and approved, and make sure they're done ahead of time. If you have questions, ask for help. I've talked about this before. I don't need to go over that again. Ask for help. This is a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. Just from me blathering on for the last hour, you know that there's a lot to it. It's complicated. There's a lot of layers to it. But know that it will stretch you and make you grow in ways you may not want to even think about. But remember to breathe and just enjoy the ride. I put this picture up here because the little girl that's up on the left, she's got a helper there holding her in the seat, but she's got this incredible fear face on. And sometimes it feels that way. Other times you're really joyful and you're yelling and screaming and having fun. And there's a lot of ups and downs to it, but overall it's just a terrific program. I think it is truly one of the best ones in the region and at headquarters. And I feel it is a privilege to be working on this program. And with that, I'm going to stop with questions, and I still might be able to go a bit over some of the RC roles and responsibilities if we have time. Any questions?
Kathleen, this is Sally Hamft, and yesterday we met with our finalist that's going to be the new grantee, and they were talking about that they didn't think that they would have to go out and get additional data. They might be able to get it from the different partners that they have. But can you do a quality assurance agreement just to plan ahead? That there's a potential that they might need to go out and collect some data, not knowing what the data is going to be yet? Or should they just wait? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that they might want to go ahead and do their best at pulling through what their quality assurance plan will be as they know it now. And if it needs to be amended, you can amend the quality assurance plan too. But I would talk with your quality assurance plan person in your region, get their insight on it. They're really the ones that are the ones that sign off on it. So I would talk with them first.
Okay. We had a meeting yesterday, so I just thought I'd ask the question today. Yeah.
Yeah. Would anyone else like to weigh in on that?
I would just say, are they saying that they're not going to be collecting any data that only their partners are?
It's unsure yet. Yeah.
So then in that case, I'd say it's almost impossible to do care level one without collecting some existing data, in which case they probably want to do a QAP for secondary data. If they really think it's not likely that they're going to do that, that their partners are going to, you know, do that for them, as a project officer, you still have to make sure it follows a QMP. So, for example, if the health department is going to be collecting all the environmental health data for the partnership, as a project officer, you still want to make sure that they have a QMP in place. And there's a little checklist that your QA person will probably make you complete as that goes along.
That's what I thought, too, because I was wondering if they were going to have, like, the environmental state organization be a partner and the Department of Health. Yeah. So we're just at the preliminary talking, so we'll work on that. So
yeah.
Thank you.
So I had a level one who actually ended up designing it so they didn't have to have a QAP. They had their partners do it. But I had to do a lot of work then in terms of keeping on top of it, making sure the partners had a QMP and met EPA standards and filling out a checklist every time they did data.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Kathleen, this is Sally again. I was just going to add one statement that you were talking about, you know, reviewing the RFP, the work plan, and that kind of stuff, and talking to other people in the region about the work plan. And also I found it helpful to go back and look at the evaluation sheets of the regional reviewers and the comments that they made when they were reviewing the proposal, because you might have missed something, and they might have caught something different. So I think it's helpful to look at those.
That's really good advice, Sally. Thank you.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions on the line or written down?
There are no additional questions online.
Okay.
Do you have any more questions on the phone? Well, Kathleen, you do have 30 minutes, so I don't know if you want to go over your other handout.
Okay. Catrice, is there any way that regional coordinator's responsibilities could be put up? Is that possible?
They would have to go to additional resources to see that because it's not a part of the presentation.
Okay.
This is Sally. Can you tell me how to get back to the additional resources without getting out and logging back in again? Is there a button to go to?
We figured it out earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, because I had to log in twice.
Okay, what we did was
if you click on the house icon,
yeah,
it'll take you back to the seminar homepage and then click links.
Okay, thank you.
It's at the bottom, right?
Yeah. Sorry if you said that before.
Probably did.
To go over then, we also did a roles and responsibilities for regional coordinators, and what I'd like to do is go over quickly who's on the phone that is a new regional.
Tiana Bloodstone line, Region 3.
Hey, Kathleen, David's here, Region 5.
Okay.
Charles Haywood, Region 2.
And I think Sharon's on as well, too.
Yeah,
so,
Sharon and Jane Sullivan is on, who is a new RC, and Nancy Curran, I don't know if I remember her name from anywhere.
Yeah, she's Region 8.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, she's with
8.
Well, welcome, everyone, and know that you're joining a great group of folks, the regional coordinators, and just to link this back to the POs, because I know there's a lot of project officers on the line, too, you should be working almost hand-in-hand with your regional coordinator, and that relationship is really important. So there's as we know, there's a few new regional coordinators on the phone, and there's quite a bit of responsibility that they have, and I apologize that this is not on a slide presentation. So I'm just going to have to verbally give it to you, but it is in a document that's part of the links.
So I'll just go over this fairly quickly, and we'll stay on time. So for new regional coordinators, regions should allow time for overlap between old and new RCs. Managers from the old offices should share information on what had been going on in the regional care program with the new office and the new regional coordinator. Take advantage of the experienced RCs and the experienced project officers in your region and take time to talk to them. You know, get their challenges, their successes, some of their failures, what to look out for, connections, who to talk to, websites to go to. That's really good, helpful information for anyone that's new. The CARE program will set up mentors for the new RCs, and I think that's already occurred. And if it hasn't happened, I believe MARVA is helping set those mentors up. Talk to your current and past project officers to find out what the past RCs have done to help the regional project officers and what other roles the RC has played so that you can learn how to, you know, kind of bring to the table everything that is most helpful. So next up is a big piece, especially now with our dwindling resources, and it's managing the CARE regional travel budget. And Sally, I know I'm going to give you a couple minutes to put some talking points together, but I'll go over these points. But Sally has been our point person. She's the regional coordinator in Region 10, and pulling together our travel budget and how it's done. But managing that travel budget is really important. So I'll go over these notes, and I want to ask Sally if she has any input after that. Develop a working relationship with your budget analyst or your travel person that really focuses on your budget so that you are kept informed when the CARE travel funds are received in the region and when travel requests are submitted for the funding. There should actually be a protocol in your region on who has access to that money, who approves those travel authorizations and travel vouchers, and how is it that the regional coordinator is going to know what their current budget is. Make sure that no travel authorizations are funded unless you approve them or whatever the protocol is, that there is a protocol in place. Work with your project officer to find out travel needs. This should be an ongoing conversation with your POs, what their two-year plan will be regarding visiting their site. And that's something that the RC should be working with the PO on. Develop a list of trips, cost them out, and make sure you have enough funds for these trips. And if you don't have enough funds, figure out what your conference call plan will be, what your 800 number is, so that you can connect to your community. Budget for the following. There's a trip for the RC or regional representative to attend the National CARE Grant Review meeting held in D.C. That, in fact, might be on the table this year for negotiating whether or not that's going to be in person or not. So we'll have to get word on that in a little bit later. But we were talking about this year planning for that to be a virtual meeting again. Travel for the new RC and new project officer to attend the project officer training. Oftentimes that's been a yearly trip, but this year we're doing it virtually, and I have a feeling we'll probably be doing that virtually from now on. So we might need to talk with headquarters and find out if that's in fact going to be the case. Travel for the CARE RC project officers or management to attend the National CARE Workshop each year. So that's something that might be talked about again and how that might be different this year, too. But most importantly, travel to the CARE communities, how much it's going to cost, how you might be able to, you know, scrimp and save and maybe just drive the GOV and there and drive back the same day, take the train. I don't know if taking buses are possible in your community, but that's how we're looking at our budgets these days. Sometimes there are no costs if a GOV is used or public transportation can be used, or at least a minimal one. Track the expenses so you do not overspend. Region 10, Sally Hamp, has been giving out updates on CARE travel spending from the EPA Financial Warehouse.
Again, remember that these funds need to be obligated by September 30th. We're actually wanting you to spend the travel money in the year that we receive it now. Check with your management and or region to determine if any other department, office, is willing to supplement your care travel budget. And I'll give you an example. Oftentimes our care work mirrors and intertwines with program work. And if you're bringing a technical expert into that community to do program work, sometimes that branch chief will pay for their travel. So as the RC, negotiate those and see if there are possibilities of getting the branch to pay for that particular person to travel. Some regional programs and offices will allow travel to staff to travel under their program's travel money. There's a lot of care management work that needs to be done. I'm not going to read this because it'll take too long, and I feel like I'm doing way too much talking. Work is needed with your project officers. Talk to other RCs. Go over terms and conditions with your PO so that you're both familiar with what's in that. Ensure that you look at the quarterly reports and that you edit them along with your grantee so that the best story can be told about what is going on. Ensure that there is progress going on and that challenges are adequately addressed and reported. Your role, I think one of the most important roles is to help your PO succeed and help your grantee succeed. And so keeping, your finger on the pulse of what's going on is really important. There is going to be a conference call for POs and RCs about the Quick Reports tool. It's a new tool out there that Martha Barber is particularly familiar with. And in this document, there's a URL that you can go to that will help you understand what this tool is and how it will help you do grant management reporting. There are go ahead.
Kathleen, this is Marva. Are you reading from a document off the additional resources? And
yes.
If so, could you let people know which document it is?
Yes, it is the Care Regional Coordinator's RC's responsibilities. And I'm going to just check with Catrice. Catrice, that is on that list, correct?
Right.
Yes, it's on the additional resources.
Okay. And I'm not going to read the whole thing to you guys. The next thing up is that there are Care Regional Coordinator's calls on a monthly basis, and Mike Vandrowski and Sally Hamp and myself help out with those. So there is a schedule. We'll get that to you. And a lot of good information is exchanged. It's where a lot of decisions or recommendations to the care administrative team occurs. So make sure that you're on those calls. There are project officer calls. We've already talked about that. We've talked about having grantee conference calls, but that hasn't seemed to be as necessary or needed right now. However, if there is a need for your grantee to get some additional help, there is always that opportunity to use a conference call to get that grantee or the project officer particular help. You'll want to go over kind of your role regarding the national training workshop and what you can do regarding that. There's always a lot of help needed to get that off the ground and to implement the national workshop. So you'll be getting notes about that, and pitching in is really a necessary thing these days. There's various care work groups and many opportunities to help. If in fact the RC can't help out regarding some of those work groups, we look to the RCs to recommend other POs to help out with those if there is a chance to use their time accordingly in that way. There's a lot of experts as POs that can help out with our work groups, too. Regarding care personnel, check with your management regarding how your RC position is documented. Many of us have CJEs that you could beg, borrow, and steal. And check with your RC if you need an exam. Check with other RCs if you need those. There is a whole process for grant awards and, again, talk with your grant specialist on what all those roles and duties are. A lot of POs may not know how to jump through all those hoops, and they'll look to you to help them out as well. So with that, I'm going to stop and ask for questions.
There actually are two questions that have come up here, Kathleen, that I will repeat since you guys can't see that. And I will attempt to answer, and then I'll ask my seasoned people on the phone like you and Sally and Mary Beth and others to jump in, okay?
Sure.
The first one is from Zoe out in Region 9. And Zoe asks, because funding for care is so competitive, what advice do you have for a new Level 1 project so that they will be competitive for Level 2 funding? And how I'm going to answer this, Zoe, is to let you know that what I see in all of the briefs I'm doing for Level 2s who did not make it to selection, Level 2 applications who were Level 1s that make it to selection. And then I'll let others jump in. One major thing I saw was the business engagement. To be a Level 2, it's different from a Level 1. Level 1, you can articulate that plan that you're going to include business. But a Level 2 has to have business engaged. And it has to be a really robust engagement to be competitive. Some people think that, in other words, it has to be more than the Chamber of Commerce. It has to be someone there who is working in the community, and Chamber of Commerce is okay for Level 1, but Level 2, we want to see how that's going to help them get to results, that business engagement. And so that's important, I believe. The other one that I've seen a lot is that a Level 2 application is still trying to do some Level 1 work. So they're still trying to do identification, which is what they should have done in their Level 1. And so I see that. And the last one that I see a lot is the whole thing about sustainability. We haven't seen, and the application is not very, it doesn't articulate very well some things they've done to become sustainable. And that's what we're looking for in the Level 2. And overall, it's how they write their grant, of course, right? It's how they write it, how they articulate their Level 1 process, how they did everything they were supposed to do in a level one to get to the Level 2. But those are the three items that I've been seeing as we've been doing oral degrees, that we see lacking in the ones that didn't get it. So I'll open this up for the other seasoned people to comment.
Yeah, this is Terry in Region 9. I think one of the useful things to do for the Level 1s, or at least for the PO, Zoe, for you, is to see what other Level 2s have done. Like, for instance, in our case, two of the most successful Level 2 grants we've had are Pacoima and Siri, that mostly relate to the project you're working on. And it would be maybe useful to talk with the directors of those two projects to see how they actually manage that transition from a one to a two. And I think in the process of doing that, the sustainability part of it is a real important part of it. But I think talking with them might help so you can see clarify the connection between the transition from one to two.
This is Maggie. So I think in the second year of, well, first of all, when you're negotiating the work plan, Kathleen gave some tips about deliverables, and in our region we really make sure they understand the process and have the deliverables even before the grant is awarded. The second year of the Level 1, when they're planning to get toward prioritization, we have them focus on what can we do about it, be thinking about what can we take action on and what would be the outcomes. And in our region, we require a final action plan. So they're thinking about, during prioritization, what are the actions that they're going to take, and we focus them on, and what would be the measurable toxic reductions in the results. And so when they apply for Level 2, you know, everything that's a priority doesn't make it into a level two application. But those things that have a measurable toxic reduction, which is the goal of level two, with strong performance measures, makes it real competitive. Also, is someone, I'm sorry.
I won't mind doing it.
Okay, someone else is talking too. So then the second thing is, in the second year of level one, we teach them strategic planning and community asset mapping and go through the sustainability checklist that, you know, Mike and others led. We think that helps them to be planning for sustainability, developing a funding plan, you know, doing the items in that checklist. Because to me, the two key things that I often don't see at the National Review Panel are, how, as Marva said, how they're going to be sustainable. Two, what are their measurable outcomes of toxic reduction? A lot of times people pick activities like education or other strategies that don't actually reduce toxics and they don't say how they're going to measure that. And to me, that's not level two. And then the third thing is we always stress the community benefits. And so as they're doing their process, we're always looking to do more community engagement. And as part of the strategic planning and community asset mapping, we say, how can this benefit the community in a sustainable way? So then you'll see that reflected in the level two applications in our region where they institute things like community health workers or community leadership or ongoing elements of their budget that demonstrate they're both sustainable and they're benefiting the community. But I would say the number one thing that separates a good level two from a runner-up is the measurable results of toxic reduction. A lot of people want to put in their priorities that don't have that, and I encourage my grantees before the RFP is published to consider there's those things you're going to apply for care level two, there's those things you're going to apply for other funding, there's those things your partners are going to do for you and leverage the funding. Make sure the things you come in for a care level two application are the things that have a measurable toxic reduction and that you seek other funding sources for the other priorities, just because that will make you more competitive as well. And so I think that element of the second year of a level one of strategic planning, sustainability checklist, community asset mapping as a means to helping them be thinking about what actions they're going to take and how they're going to sustain them and be measurable about them really would give them an edge.
This is Kathleen, and I would add a few other things. I would be very persnickety if I were them about their budget and linking it to their work plan. The budget is scrutinized in both level one and level two, and to really think about how they're best going to deliver the funding and the work itself and matching the two up. I would also assume that complete strangers are going to be reading and evaluating their proposal. So to be incredibly clear and tell a picture, you know, explain a picture, explain it so that folks that really don't know what is going on in their community get it. Those are the proposals that win. And then also, I would recommend that they have someone that they trust that knows what's going on in the community, that has a clue about what their mission is regarding their own mission, but also the mission of the Care Level 1 or Care Level 2 project, and have that person read their proposal and critique it before it's sent in. What we see a lot of times is that folks just have not done the kind of thorough QA/QC on their proposals, and they get marked down because of it. So I think all of those things that everyone shared just now are really good advice for those that are moving from level one to level two. Anyone else?
This is Sally. I was just going to say that what you talked about, Kathleen, telling the picture of what they did during the level one, really document it so that when they go to write the grant application for the level two, they can tell us their whole process and what they did and how they've done the prioritization. So you get a clear picture of that whole process. And then when they go to talk about what they're going to do for the level two, not include too much education, because we've seen a lot of the level twos, they're still wanting to go out and educate the community on things instead of really proposing what they're going to in their action plans of getting results like Maggie talked about.
And this is Maggie. I would add one last thing, because you're a project officer on level one, and you're trying to prepare them to do a really great job and make them competitive. One thing we do in our region is we have a lot of peer mentoring. So, for example, you know, City of Gary mentored Improving Kids' Environment that came after them. When City of Gary was trying to prepare for their level two and they had identified, you know, healthy homes as a strategy, West Michigan, a previous level two, mentored them. What I try to do is in the beginning of the project to establish a peer mentor. And they tend, in my region, they tend to like to be close geographically in the same state if that's possible, or closely aligned in what their issues and what they're seeking to do. So I think if you have a strong peer mentor, someone who's been through this process before and has been successful, I think you learn a lot from that. I also think the mentor learns a lot, too.
Any other unrelated questions? Or I think there was another question that had been written up.
Yeah, there's one more. There's one more, and it's a comment, but I'm going to turn it into a question because I think we need to say something about it. So Sharon wrote a comment. Sharon from Region 6 wrote a comment about the need to share information from the old RC to the new RC is very important for the new RC to understand their role. So what I was going to say to Sharon was absolutely correct. You know, we hear you. We've been struggling with this. There's been some things that we have currently started to do. One of those early on was the mentoring of new RCs, with seasoned RCs. The other one is what Sally and Kathleen have done with the RC one-on-one document. But I want my seasoned RCs to comment on this for her because we hear her pain, correct, ladies? We hear her pain, and we want to help her in every way we can.
Well, Marva, this is Tiana Blunt, and I'm not a seasoned RC, but I did want to kind of comment on that because I was going to make a comment myself, and this is for new project officers as well. In the past few days, I've really been active on using the ESC, and I really found out that some of my old grantees weren't really active on it, and so I would really, really encourage the use of that tool because it's all of the past information, you know, reports, you know, information, handouts, marketing. I mean, everything is up there that past grantees have used, and it's a great jumping off point. You can kind of reference that, and then if you have further questions that aren't, you know, answered by looking at those documents, then, you know, that kind of gives you a jumping off point to contact your mentor. Whether you're an RC or a project officer, and kind of follow up with questions. And so I would just really encourage the use of that. I've actually been on there and sent a grantee, you know, example documents to kind of follow up and use as a template, you know, whether it's final reports or other reporting requirements or that type of thing. And so I think if we really start utilizing that tool, because it is kind of hard with our different schedules and people have other responsibilities to always get someone on the phone when you have a question, and sometimes you need an answer that day. And so I think if we continue to utilize the ESC and really put up documents, information that we are all agreeing upon, that, you know, it's kind of like a one-stop shop if we can't reach anyone, then it will be very, very helpful for RCs and project officers and grantees.
And Marva or Gail, this is Sally. Can you talk about how the ESC is going away and we're switching over to a new system? Or for right now, how we can get, like, the new project officers linked into the ESC?
Yeah, that's good because I really can't talk about how it's going away yet. Unless, yeah, because we don't know when that's going to happen. But how they can get linked in, Remy's here.
Well, as long as you're an APA employee, you can just go in and request access. When you sign in, when you go to the front page, you'll see underneath where you are to log in, it will say request access, and it'll ask you for your email. If you're not an EPA employee, then you have to put in a sponsor, and you can just put in Remington Jackson as your sponsor, and then I'll get an email saying that you're requesting access to Environmental Science Connector. Or you can email me.
Can the new applicants, the ones that are the finalists, have access now, or do we want to wait until they become a official grantee before we give them access?
You know, if you guys think they're almost going to get it, you know, I don't have any problem, you know, letting them have it. Because what you're telling me is that, wait a minute, let me back up. Officially, they're not awarded, though. And
right.
I think that to be safe, you need to send them what they need.
Okay.
Only reason I'm backing up, Sally, is because we are under a lot of scrutiny lately.
I know.
But
once they are awarded,
come October, they can have access.
Yeah.
Right. And they will need to, when they request access, like I was saying, they will need to put a sponsor, and they can just put Remington Jackson, and it'll come directly to me as far as the request for accessing it. Otherwise. That's how you get access.
Yeah, so any EPA person can give themselves access, you're saying?
No, they can. They have to request it, but EPA, it's easier for EPA folks to ask for request access to it. Outside, people have to go through a sponsor. But EPA people, if you go and request access, it'll bounce right directly to me and say such and such wants to join the project. With a few more steps if you're outside of EPA, though.
Okay, so to be helpful, if anybody on this phone needs additional information on what they need to do, they can email Remington Jackson. So that's jackson.remington, just like the rifle.
2M-R-E-M-M. It is a rifle.
All right. Hopefully that answers.
Kathleen, this is Sally. I was just going to add a couple things about the care travel budget, because you went over a lot of that. But yesterday on the regional coordinators call, we talked about that the FY11 budget numbers have been given to the Office of Air, and those funds are in the process of being reprogrammed out to the regions. So what we were talking about, having a really good relationship with your budget person, so you know when those funds have been reprogrammed. And I think, Marva, you said that you'd also send the regional coordinators an email when you knew Office of Air was getting ready to reprogram the funds actually to the regions. And just again stressing that those funds need to be obligated by the end of September.
Yeah, so they've already placed them in the system. I'm just waiting for get confirmation. So when I get confirmation, they will actually send me the actual accounting line that they sent to the region. And so what I do then, I'll turn around and send it out to the regional RCs. So I want to turn this over to Catrice.
If there are no more questions, we'll take a break at this point, and we'll start back up at 1:55 for Keisha Holliday from OGD to do her grant do's and don'ts presentation. So if we can start back up at 1:55, that'll ensure that we can end on time. So I'm going to turn it over to Keisha so that she can start the grants, do's, and don'ts presentation.
Okay. I am Keisha Holliday, and I'm the compliance officer within the Office of Grants and Debarments National Policy Training and Compliance Division. And I just want to thank the care coordinators for inviting me to be a part of today's webinar. We're so excited. And one of the reasons why we're really excited is because being part of the compliance team, we do a lot of work, or we work directly with the grant specialists all the time, but we don't get a chance to work directly with our project officers. Typically, from a compliance point of view, I only talk to a lot of the project officers as a result of postal ward management, and it's usually because of a situation where a grantee may have not recorded funds properly, or if there's some issue with the way the grantee actually managed their grant. So this is an excellent opportunity for us to kind of partner with the programs, and we're really excited. Today's presentation is on can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Today's presentation is going to be on grants, do's, and don'ts. And basically, I'm just going to go over some things that have come up over the past couple of years of areas that we see
could be potential weaknesses. And so we want to kind of capitalize on that to make sure that, again, we can strengthen our working relationship with the programs and also the grant specialists.
Can I ask what slide you might be on?
I am on the very first slide. This is do's and don'ts. I think it's number 51.
Be slide 52 if
52.
You're following along on that.
Are we all on 52?
Yes, slide 52.
Okay, so the first important thing that you want to do as a project officer is you want to ask questions. Please ask as many questions as you think are necessary. The purpose of asking the questions is to make sure that you and the grantee are on the same page in terms of the requirements of the grant and that the work of the grant that the recipient is going to perform. Everybody is on the same page as far as what's going to happen and what's going to be expected. We would also ask that you read the grant award. The terms and conditions are usually outlined as part of the grant document, and it's the recipient's responsibility to adhere to the federal guidelines, and all of that is going to be outlined in the actual grant award document. It's also nice as a project officer for you to take a look at that because it also has project officer terms and conditions as well. The next thing you want to do is contact your recipient often. Please communicate with your recipient often and early. This kind of helps to alleviate misconceptions down the road. I can tell you from a compliance point of view that we often have a lot of confusion in terms of translation of what's put in an email about what a recipient can and cannot do in terms of recording transactions, in terms of sort of amending a grant without actually getting project officer approval. So it's best to contact your recipient and communicate with them early and often. You also want to be clear about your expectations. And last but not least, you want to focus on being a partner. Again, we like to think of grants as a gift with strings. And since it is a gift with strings, there are certain federal guidelines and regulations. It's like an investment. The federal government wants to invest in the smaller community, but they're also looking for a great return on their investment. So, again, as part of being a project officer, the most important thing you can do is communicate with your recipient often and early. We can go to the next slide. So, again, what we don't want you to do is we don't want you to wait if you think there's going to be a potential issue. We don't want you to wonder, like, what am I supposed to do? We want you to ask questions. We're here to help. So if it's something that you see that may be a potential issue, the grant specialists are always available to answer any questions. And then if it looks like it can be a potential compliance issue, you can always give the compliance team a call. Next slide. Recipient responsibilities. Recipients are responsible for actually reading the requirements of the grant award. This will give them the limitations of what they have in terms of actually fulfilling the work of the grant. It'll tell them what they're allowed to do versus what they're not allowed to do. The grant award will also identify organizations within EPA or officials within EPA in terms of compliance and where they can go to ask questions. It also lists out a lot of the cost principles and the regulations that they're going to be responsible for adhering to. By reading the award, it'll tell them a lot about the financial expectations as well as the programmatic expectations regarding their project. And the main thing is that they need to know what they're going to be held accountable to during the post-award monitoring phase. So, for instance, one of the things that they're required to do is to maintain a separate accounting system, especially if they have multiple federal grant awards or they have multiple projects. And the reason for this is because they're not allowed to commingle funds. A lot of this will be spelled out in part of the terms and conditions, but these are things that they need to know. So if they don't read the entire award, then we're going to have issues. So one of the things you want to stress to them is that they go through the grant award, and then they can ask you any questions that they may have because you're always the first line of contact with the recipient. And then if there's something that you can answer, again, you can always forward it over to the grant specialist or, worst case scenario, someone from the compliance team. Next slide. Now, project officer responsibilities. We don't expect for you to know everything about the cost principles that are related to your particular recipient.
I didn't want to switch over. I didn't want to mess things up.
Okay, so we want to make sure that people have their phone on mute. Please do that. Thank you.
Yeah, we don't expect for you to know everything about the cost principles word for word, but we do want you to familiarize yourself with the different cost principles that affect your recipient. So for nonprofits, the cost principles that kind of guide their existence would be CFR Part 230. For colleges and universities, it's going to be Part 220. And for states and local governments, as well as tribes, it's going to be Part 225. Next slide. The cost principles are important. I should go back to the previous slide. I'm sorry. They're really important because they're separate and distinct from other OMB circulars, and they're used to give guidance to the recipients on the administrative management and monitoring requirements that they're going to have to adhere to. Next slide. This is going to be your responsibility for budget review. This is a very important part of the application phase. And even though the grant specialists are going to do a second eyeball of the budgets that the recipients submit, it's very important for you to take a glance at it just to make sure that costs seem reasonable. The one thing that the grant specialists are not going to be able to do is to look at the budget from a programmatic review point of view to determine whether or not costs for certain projects or certain types of work are like generally costs that are acceptable as far as an industry type requirement. But they can look at it from an administrative point of view to determine whether or not the recipient is recording costs like as indirect costs and direct costs. They can also look at it from a point of view to determine whether or not the recipient is actually applying their indirect cost rate equitably across programs and that they're actually using the correct basis and so forth. So the one thing you want to do is, you know, take a look at the budget. You want to make sure that the costs that are represented on the budget are reasonable, allocable, and allowable to the grant. And also on this slide, just, you know, as a general courtesy, I kind of list the different types of cost categories that are typically seen in the recipient's budget. So you'll have personnel costs, fringe benefits, travel, equipment, supplies, contracts, and then there's the indirect cost section. There's also a section where it may show cost match, but for the most part, these are like the main categories that are going to appear on the recipient's budget. This is go to the next slide. This is a list of costs that are deemed unallowable. In no way, shape, form, or fashion are we allowed to, or is the recipient allowed to charge for these type of costs. So it's the advertising and promotions. Alcohol is definitely prohibited. Entertainment, and then food that doesn't contribute towards the recipient actually reaching the goal or the work of the project. Food is an allowable cost, but it's there has to be significant reason for, you know, having food or paying for food for conferences. Fundraising is also an unallowable cost, and then so is bad debt. And the one that's not on this list is lobbying. The recipients can't use federal funds to lobby.
They cannot, right?
Cannot.
Yeah, okay. It wasn't clear.
Yeah, cannot. They cannot use federal funds for lobbying. So on the next slide, there's a small list of kind of red flags. And these are things that you can kind of look out at for, like, when you're actually doing the budget review. If the narrative of the project and the budget don't sync, if it just doesn't sound right and it raises a red flag, that's definitely an opportunity for you to ask additional questions. Another opportunity would be when progress reports and the dollars that the recipient actually requests don't sync. From a compliance point of view, when we see whole dollar drawdowns or when we see instances where the recipient has drawn down all the money at one time, those are definitely red flags for us. As far as a whole dollar drawdown, generally speaking, you know, unless it's a contract and it's a certain type of contract, invoices don't come in round dollars. So there's usually some sense that are attached to it. So it's not that that's a problem, but it's a red flag for us. We kind of, you know, want to do a little more investigation just to make sure. And then in terms of drawing all the dollars down at one time, the recipients aren't supposed to gain interest on federal funds. And so when we see that, you know, the recipient was awarded a grant on June the 16th and then on June 20th, they've drawn down all the funds, it's a red flag for us because we want to make sure that the recipient is going to have money available down the road to make sure that the work of the grant is completed. And so when you receive progress reports or you're doing your checks and kind of look in the financial data warehouse and you kind of see these things, these should be a red flag for you also. Next slide. These are some of the remedies that we kind of put in place. We like to think of our working relationships with the recipient as a win-win situation for EPA as well as for the communities. And so we err on the side that the recipients really want to perform a good job and that they're really interested in getting the best environmental results possible, and they want to improve the communities in which they're working. But there are times when, from an administrative point of view, the recipient does not record charges properly. They're not properly documented. And in those cases, when we do postal word monitoring, our responsibility would be to make sure that the recipient complies with all the terms and conditions of their agreement. At this phase, we're not interested in imposing additional requirements, but if we have to, we will. Examples of additional requirements would be putting a recipient on reimbursement, which means that they can't draw funds down until they provide us with a copy of an invoice to show that this is a legitimate transaction, and they'd have to document it. So basically they would have to use their own funds to cover their expenses and then get reimbursed from the government as opposed to being able to draw down in advance. Other remedies that we have in place would be to totally disallow costs. So if during the time that we're doing a, you know, postal work review and we see that recipients have purchased something that they should not have, if they entered in a sole source contract and there was no justification for that contract, we would question those dollars, and there's a possibility that we would totally disallow it because of that. And so these are some of the things, again, that we have in place to safeguard federal funds when the recipient doesn't comply with the terms and conditions. But for the most part, we really do try to come up with win-win situations because we know that, or at least we try to give them the benefit of the doubt because we know that they really are interested in improving communities, and it's probably more of an error as opposed to all-in-out fraud. However, there are some times where recipients have been suspended or their award has been suspended. And there's also opportunities or instances where we have just said, okay, this recipient can't receive any additional funds. So from your point of view, we just want to make sure that you are aware of all of everything that's going on with the program. Hello?
We're here.
Are we okay?
Yes. Yeah, we're here.
Okay. I got some feedback. I wasn't sure if someone was saying something.
No, actually, we've got a number of questions. I don't know how you want to handle it. Do you want to handle them now, or you want to take them later? Or?
We can do it now. If you can stop me when you get a question, that's fine.
Okay. Well, we have about 3 questions on the board.
Okay, go ahead.
Want me to read them, or Remy, you want to read them?
Okay, the first question is from James Sullivan. He said, do all problematic conditions placed in IGMS actually get to the grantee? For example, if a PO customizes a problematic condition with grantee and in the FR, will that custom condition make it into the document signed by the approving official?
Yes. It will definitely make it as part of the grant award.
Okay.
I would also say if you have a special concern about that and you want to make sure, you can also forward the term and condition directly to your grant specialist.
Okay. The next question is from Kathleen Fenton, and it says, what exactly is meant by advertising promotion? How does this grantee advertise things such as available jobs, meetings, and activities?
You're talking about as far as an allowable cost?
Yes. Yes. Tisha, yes.
Okay. So I think, like, for your program, generally speaking, we say advertising and promotion is not allowed. But I think for, like, the CARE program, there are particular instances where advertising could be allowed. I think it's, like, what is being advertised or what are you using advertising for? If the CARE folks are having a conference and they need participation, or if they're doing a study and they need participation, then they, as part of their budget, they can put in whatever, like, form of advertising that they need to draw people to that particular event.
And so I guess the other caveat here is to work with your grant specialist on that. Is that correct?
Exactly. So in terms of the unallowable costs, or actually all of these items that are listed here are kind of covered under what we term the food policy. It's really other costs is what it is, but under that policy, it kind of details, like, what is allowable, what is not allowable, and then it also has a list and definitions for things that are allowable but with caveats or conditions. It's called the food policy. If you refer to that, the grant specialist will actually know what you're talking about. But, again, once you're reviewing the budget and you notice things and they kind of raise a red flag for you, you can always go to your grant specialist or to someone on the compliance team, and we'll kind of work with you through that. As part of the food policy, there's a checklist that project officers can use to help determine whether costs are allowable and unallowable. And, again, the best thing to do when reviewing that is to make sure you partner with your grant specialist or your GMO just to make sure that you guys are on the same page, because what has happened before, some project officers have told the recipients that certain costs were allowable, and then when they got to the grants office, they deemed that it was not, and so there were some issues there because in the end, the grants folks wanted to seek reimbursement from the recipient for unallowed costs. But there is a checklist that's designed to help go through this process, and again, the grants folks will be more than happy to work with you through that.
Okay, the next question is from Wadi Muhammad. When you refer to doing down for advertising promotion, what is the difference between community outreach, a.k.a. paying for flyers, for community canvassing?
You said, what's the difference between, I didn't hear the last thing you said.
Okay, so what is the difference between community outreach, a.k.a. paying for flyers, for community canvassing?
Yeah, it's like I said, the best thing to do is consult with your grant specialist and kind of use the checklist that's provided for project officers, where they can use that to determine whether or not costs are allocable, reasonable, and allowable for the grant.
Okay.
I think it's, you know, literally what it is, but it's almost like on a case-by-case basis.
The next question is from James Sullivan. Does the CARE program have a policy on no-cost time extensions? If they are not on schedule, do we give up or let them stretch out their timeline?
Yeah, so we do have a policy. This is Marva. We do have a policy on no-cost time extensions. Any of your projects can get those. So we don't give up. We do not. We never give up. We always allow them to stretch out their timeline. And I'm going to turn this over to some of the seasons, our seasons on the phone, if they want to add to that, like Maggie and or Sally or whoever. But I guess I said enough. Did I say enough, ladies? Okay.
Okay, and the final question is from Debbie Lowe. In the additional resources section, there is a document called Draft Terms and Conditions. Will there be a final version developed for this year's CARE Award?
Kathleen, you want to take that? That's your document, I believe.
Kathleen has stepped out for a minute. Can we hold that until she comes back?
Sure, we can.
Maybe to the end of the presentation?
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Check back with us. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for letting us know. Okay, Keisha, back to you.
Okay. So, again, this is just a list of the most common unallowable costs that we see. And, again, if you have any questions about this, feel free to contact your grant specialist. They'll be more than happy to work with you and walk through or give a better explanation of what the recipients can pay for using federal funds. This is a little
think we were on the remedy slide, mm-hmm. which was slide number 59 is where we left off before we had questions. Is that correct?
Yes, Keisha, that's correct. You got stopped into slide 59.
Okay. So again, these are some of the remedies that we take, that we use to try to work with the recipients to make sure that we can achieve the environmental results that we want and to make sure that we have improved working relationships with the recipients. Again, we kind of err on the side by giving the recipients the benefit of the doubt, but it goes back to what I started the presentation by saying is that it is so important for you as a project officer as well as the recipient to read the entire grant award document, because that's where a lot of the terms and conditions are, and at the end, or during the post-award monitoring phase, these are the kinds of things that we're going to be looking to hold the recipient accountable to. Oftentimes what we find is that recipients will answer shop, and they'll call like the grant specialist, and the grant specialist will say no to something, and then they'll contact you because they're not getting the answer that they want to hear. So we want to make sure that we're all on the same page, which is why I was so excited about being able to be a part of this forum, because in the spirit of one EPA, when the project officers tell the recipient something, they're looking for that to be the one answer. They're not looking for it to be any different than what the project officer says. And then we kind of look or end up with egg on our face, especially in the instance where the IG does an audit and the recipient comes back and they have an email trail, or they printed copies of an email where they've had conversations with the project officers that, you know, told them that it was okay for them to do A, B, and C, and then either the IG or the compliance team is questioning those costs or transactions. Are there any more questions? No? No new questions? So now we're on the slide number 60 that says project officer responsibilities for monitoring. Again, it's so imperative that you review the progress reports diligently. You want to make sure that the recipient stays on close to target with the project as possible. As was just mentioned, there are opportunities for no-cost extensions. But for the most part, if the recipient is submitting their progress reports in a timely fashion, you want to make sure that you're reviewing them to make sure that the project is moving along as it should. You also want to take the time to kind of monitor any of the programmatic conditions that you guys have set. And you want to make sure that there's complete performance and financial monitoring. So with that, there's two types of monitoring that's done. That's the programmatic baseline monitoring, and then there's the programmatic advanced monitoring. I know for sure under the programmatic advanced monitoring, it's you guys get credit as following the performance measures for doing advanced monitoring on that 10% of your active grant awards, and that it falls under your programmatic monitoring. There's a separate protocol for that. I know we have one on the administrative side for on-site and desk reviews, but there's also protocols that as a project officer you should use in completing both the baseline and the advanced monitoring. If you have questions about either of those protocols or about information that's on it, you can definitely ask, again, the grant specialist as well as anyone in the compliance team will be able to help you through that and answer any questions that you have. And again, I think it's been a recurring theme throughout the webinar so far, is that it's just so important to communicate, to make sure that we're all on the same page and we're all representing EPA. Are there any questions? So this is an opportunity for me to talk about some things that are in the pipeline that's going to be new for grants starting fiscal year 2012, which starts for us in October. And we've had a couple of work groups that have been formed to try to streamline the grants process for our recipients. We've got enough complaints from our recipients and then from different program offices, and so we've decided that we would put our heads together to try to come up with some ideas of how we could make life a little easier for the grant specialist without necessarily bending the rules, but also, you know, again, to strengthen the partnership that we have with the folks in our community. So the first new change in grants for the new fiscal year would be our tribal indirect cost policy. This is going to affect you, especially during your budget review process. Before, our policy for, well, we can go to the next slide because
held it there also. Slide 62. Currently, our process for all recipients is that they must have a negotiated indirect cost rate in order to seek reimbursement for indirect costs. And what we said is that if it's a new nonprofit recipient or it's a new tribe and they've never had a negotiated rate, we've said that they had 90 days after being notified that they're going to receive an award to actually submit a proposal to have the rate negotiated. So what that means to you is that you may see a rate or a dollar amount budgeted for indirect costs, and that's okay if at the time of the award they don't actually have an agreement in place. We've allowed recipients to budget for that, but then we give them 90 days to submit their proposal. So prior to, well now what we do is if they don't have that, if they don't submit anything within 90 days, we just tell them they're not allowed to claim indirect costs on that particular grant award ever. But, again, because we've listened and heard some of the complaints of our recipients, new for the upcoming fiscal year would be tribes should get their rate negotiated. However, in the event that they don't, if they have a negotiated rate agreement that's up to 3 years old, we would allow them to use that rate. And the reason is because the Department of Interior is a cognizant agency for all tribes, so they're responsible for negotiating rates for the tribes. There's a policy along the federal government that any rate that's negotiated by any one federal agency would be accepted by another. So since we're not the cognizant agency for tribes, we can't hold them to stricter regulations than what their cognizant agency does. And so since the Department of Interior allows their tribes to use a rate that's up to 3 years old, we have to do so too. What that means to you is we're in 2009, or come October, we'll be in 2012, I'm sorry. If they have a rate that's marked 2010, we can allow them to use that because their cognizant agency does. Another option would be that the tribes can now elect for a 10% flat rate, and that would be 10% of salaries and wages. They can opt for this rate without ever having to submit an indirect cost rate proposal. And we thought this would be good to extend as an option because it's a nominal rate, so it's not a lot, but it's enough to help them recover some of their overhead costs. We were hoping that, you know, by offering the 10% rate, that most recipients know that they're entitled to more, so it would encourage more recipients to actually go through the proposal submission process. But we also realized that a lot of the recipients from the CARE program are smaller mom-and-pop type organizations, and they're just not savvy at some of the larger organizations. They can't afford to hire accountants to develop proposals, and they might not even understand all that's needed to actually develop their proposal. So in this case, the tribes can opt for a 10% flat rate, and it would be 10% of salaries and wages. So that's another option that's going to be available at the beginning of the fiscal year. And last but not least, a tribe can actually use a provisional or final indirect cost rate that's from an existing grant with DOI. So say they don't have a negotiated rate in place, they haven't submitted a proposal, but they have a grant award with the Department of Interior. On that grant award, if the Department of Interior allows them to use a particular rate, we would accept that because it's an award with their cognizant agency. So to us, it's no different than them having an agreement in place. The only thing we ask is that that grant award have the same budget period, project period, as the award that we're going to elect from EPA. Are there any questions about the new tribal policy?
Keisha, this is Catrice. I do have a question. So if they're able to use the rate from DOI, would we need a copy of that grant that they have with DOI, or do we just take their word that that's the rate they're supposed to be using?
Okay, so at the project officer level, if they budget for that amount and it shows on their budget form, and if they've supplied a copy of the grant award to you, at that point, that's fine. If they haven't, the grant specialists are going to ask for it. So ultimately, they will have to submit a copy of the grant award from DOI that actually shows that they're allowed to charge that particular rate on the grant that they have with DOI.
This is
we're not asking you to request it from the recipient, but the grant specialists are definitely going to request it before they finish processing the grant.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. But we just want you to be aware of what the new options are going to be.
Okay.
So Keisha, any other questions? Yeah, Keisha, this is Maggie. And did you say you're going to extend this to nonprofits in 2012?
We have a new policy for nonprofits. That's on the next slide. It's very similar to the tribal IDC policy, but there's one portion that's different. So we're going to talk about that next. But, yes, there is a new policy that's going to go into effect for the nonprofit.
All right.
Are there any more questions about the tribal policy? Okay, so we can go to the next slide. So for nonprofits, at some point, I'll say prior to October 2003, which is the fiscal government fiscal year 2004, EPA had a GAO audit, a performance audit on indirect costs and how we treated it and what we expected from our recipients. And based on that review, we actually got dinged for bad grants management because basically we told our recipients, come up with your rate, stick it in a drawer. If we need it, we'll ask for it. So it's sort of the honor system. And based on that honor system, we realized that not all of our recipients were quite honest, and there were a lot of recipients that were claiming costs that they weren't necessarily entitled to. So from that point, we started this pilot program where we said, again, that all nonprofit recipients either must have an indirect cost rate in place at the time of the award or that they had 90 days after receiving their award to submit their proposal to their federal cognizant agency for negotiation. And we're still doing that today, but we're also going to offer them two of the options that we offer to the tribes. So in addition to getting a negotiated indirect cost rate and going through the whole proposal process, we're offering the flat 10% rate to our nonprofit recipients as well. If you notice, on the tribal side, it's 10% of salaries and wages only. On the nonprofit side, because we're the cognizant agency, we're not dictating what their base should be. So it could be 10% of salaries and wages. It could be 10% of salary, wages, and fringe benefits, 10% of total direct costs, or 10% of modified total direct costs. But it's only going to be the flat 10%. And what I'll say, too, about the flat 10%, once the recipient elects to use the flat 10% rate, they will not be allowed to charge any other rate on that grant award for the life of the award. So what that means to you is that if we have a two-year agreement with the recipient, in year one, they elect to use a 10% rate, they can't in year two decide they're going to submit a proposal for negotiation and then come back and ask for an amendment to now charge the 50% rate. They have to use the 10% for the life of that award. Now, if after the first year they decide to get a negotiated rate and that rate comes up to be about 50% and they want to use that rate, they can only apply the negotiated rate to a new grant award that they receive from EPA. And it's the same with the tribes. If the tribes elect to use the 10% rate, that's the rate they have to use for the life of that grant award. The other option that we're using for nonprofits would be also if they have a current grant award with their cognizant federal agency that dictates that they're allowed to use a certain indirect cost rate, we will allow them to provide us a copy with that grant award, provided that the grant award corresponds with the project period, performance period, budget period of the grant from EPA. Are there any questions about the nonprofit tribal policy?
Yeah, this is Maggie. So this will take effect the beginning of FY 2012?
Well, some regions with significant that are heavily inundated with tribes have already started implementation of the tribal policy.
Tribal.
The policy will be final.
Can you repeat that again? There's lots of echo.
So my question has like two parts to it.
Wait, Maggie, hold on a second, please. Can everybody else put their phone on mute except for Maggie and Keisha? That would help, I think.
Okay, my question is two-part. The first part is, when can we apply this? For nonprofits?
At the beginning of the fiscal year, yes.
Okay.
For nonprofits, the beginning of the fiscal year, for tribes, it's being implemented now. So a lot of the regions that have had significant issues with tribes have already started implementing tribal policy, and that's okay. The reason why I can't allow you to do it for the nonprofits yet is because we're still vetting the nonprofit policy. I can tell you, though, that the meat and potatoes of it is not going to change. This is going to be the structure. It just has to go through a vetting process. The tribal policy has already been vetted, and actually it's getting ready to go out in the Federal Register. Once that's done, it's final.
So we could not use it now for the grants we're about to award for October 1st, the 10% for nonprofits. Tribes, I understand tribes, and actually the CARE program's not making any awards to tribes this year.
So you have grants that you're going to use now, but they're going to be active as October 1st?
We're in the process. We've selected some grants. We're going to award them October 1st. Can they have the 10% flat rate, or we have to wait?
No, yeah.
Okay, now here's part two. So we awarded a grant this year. We gave them the 90-day term and condition. They couldn't come up, you know, they realized it was too hard to develop an indirect cost proposal, so no indirect costs were allowed in the grant. Year two, you know, can they amend it and do a budget modification and get the 10% for year two of a CARE level two? This is Detroit, I'm asking.
So they already have an active award with EPA, but because they didn't meet the 90-day term and condition, you're asking starting October if they could actually try to get an amendment to use the flat rate?
For year two, right.
For year two. That would be a programmatic call. And so it would be something from the programs that you guys would have to discuss. I mean, I can tell you, generally speaking, if the recipients don't meet the 90-day term and condition, we're told or we tell them that you can't get indirect costs for the life of that award. But that was also before we had the new policy in place.
Right. We told them that, too. But we're hoping the new policy, they can come back to us. All right. Thanks, Keisha.
Because you have to keep in mind that, you know, once we give them the grant award, the total dollar amount of the grant award is not going to change. So what happens is, you know, right now they haven't budgeted for indirect costs. At least there were no out for any indirect costs. But then if they come back to do the amendment, that means that that's going to be less money that they're going to have available to actually perform the work that's listed under their direct costs.
So
the EPA is not going to give them any more than what the total amount of the award was for. So at that point, they may just have to try to do an amendment to do some budget line item readjustment, and maybe that could help cover some of the cost.
Right, that was my question, because they do a budget mod for year two for the flat 10%.
Yes, but it definitely has to be approved by the project officer.
Uh-huh. And when you said it's a program call, did you mean the CARE National program has to make a decision?
The project officer, I guess, working with the GMO.
Okay,
yeah.
So we should do that at the regional level then.
Yes.
All right.
Maggie, that's what I'm hearing. It's between the regional PO and the budget readjustment and your regional grant specialist.
Yeah, we have wonderful regional grant specialists and project officers, so we'll pursue that. But the project officer's here and he has the questions, so.
Yeah, so you're basically follow the same process that you would follow for any other, the normal amendments to the grant.
All right, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Keisha, this is Sally Hampton, Region 10, and the applicant that we're working with right now for the next CARE grant, they don't have an indirect cost rate, but they'd included some costs in the application, and so we told them they had to take that out. But so is there some, like, can we see the draft policy so they know how to apply that 10%? Because you said they could either use it for 10% of salaries, 10% of other costs, and that kind of thing. So is there some, like, a policy that we can share with them right now if they would want to start using an indirect cost rate starting in October?
Well, right now the actual policy is still in draft form, so I can't, like, give you a copy of the draft policy until we finish at least vetting it through the GMOs. Because they're going to have an opportunity to comment or to see if we need to make some adjustments to the nonprofit policy. I can't give that to you now. As soon as it's done, or at least as soon as we're finished vetting it through the GMOs and the GCRC, I'll be more than happy to provide you a copy of it.
Okay.
This is Kathleen, and I have a question. So I want to be clear. So if a grantee does not have an indirect cost rate, they can, there's three options on the table. They can do a line item, they can do the 10% one, or they can go in for a formal IDC policy, a formal one, and create it and go through whatever federal agency to get that done. Is that correct?
It depends on the type of recipient. As I mentioned, there's a nonprofit policy, which is something that EPA can control because we're only the cognizant agency to nonprofits. But for the tribal policy, there's other options. So basically, generally speaking, all recipients must submit a proposal in order to be able to seek reimbursement for indirect costs. But in addition to submitting a proposal, what we're now saying is that we can offer the recipient a nominal 10% rate. Most recipients will know that they're actually entitled to more because indirect costs are based on what your financial statements can support. I can tell you, as far as nonprofits are concerned, the average nonprofit indirect cost rate that EPA negotiates is about 56%. So it really would be more beneficial for the recipient to actually submit a proposal and go through the entire negotiation process. But we do understand that there are some nonprofits that are just not savvy and can't afford to either, one, pay for an audit or hire an accountant to develop a proposal. But since we're interested in making sure that we strengthen our ties in the community and we want to help the recipients, we've decided that we could offer them a nominal 10% rate. And so that 10% can be applied to whatever base the recipient actually chooses. So it could be salaries and wages. It could be salaries, wages, and fringe. So we're not telling them what base, because when they submit their actual proposals for negotiation, we don't dictate the base either. So normally the recipients will choose what base based on their organizational structure.
Right. I get that. My kind of the more specific question is, they don't have to opt for the 10% or the formal one. They can still do a line item if they wish to, correct?
When you say line item, I'm not exactly sure what you mean.
Direct cost budget, where there is no indirect line at all.
Mm-hmm.
They can
so
still do
if a recipient, if they're not budgeting for any indirect costs, then there's no need to either opt for the flat rate or to submit a proposal. If this is their only federal grant award, then everything they do is going to be directly related to the grant, so it's going to be considered a direct cost. In the instance where we were mentioned they could, you know, do an amendment and for a line item adjustment, it's for those recipients that have actually budgeted for indirect costs. Like she said that initially they budgeted for indirect costs, but for whatever reason they didn't meet the 90-day term and condition. And so at that point, under the current rule, we told them that they're not allowed to claim indirect costs on the particular award. But considering come October 1st, we're offering these options, she wanted to know if they could amend the grant award. Now, say they actually, some recipients will negotiate an indirect cost rate in the middle of their grant. And this is recipients that never had an indirect cost rate, but because their organizational structure may have changed or because they may have gotten additional federal awards, they now, you know, will negotiate a rate, and it's in the middle of the grant period. So they're going to ask, well, we have this current award. Can we now charge indirect costs on this award? And the answer would be they can, you know, petition to do an amendment. It has to be approved by the project officer. But just because their rate now is 50% doesn't necessarily mean that EPA is going to be able to give them 50%, because it all depends on how they had those expenses outlined in the budget. We probably would be able to provide some relief, but they can always ask to do the budget line item adjustment. For example, say they budgeted for travel and didn't take all of the travel. They could ask to use some of those travel dollars to cover indirect costs.
Okay, but I think my question, though, still hasn't been answered, but I think the answer is yes. And I just want to maybe push this to some RCs that might have information on this. Our grantees have often not had indirect cost rates, and so that can still occur. An award can still occur if the grantee does not have an indirect cost rate or does not opt for the nonprofit or the tribal one, if they line item and direct cost out each of their particular expenses. And for instance, it would be personnel, insurance, fringe benefits, electricity, rent, all of those things could be direct cost line items, that oftentimes are covered under indirect cost rate. And I just want to make clear for folks that are negotiating that if they don't have an indirect cost rate or don't opt for these or can't because it's not done yet, they can still do a direct line item cost or direct cost rate. And I guess I want to ask for clarity from other RCs if they think that, in fact, is true.
This is Maggie. I don't think so.
Yeah.
We had one of the audits in West Michigan, and they didn't say that, but they interpreted that way, and they disallowed the cost. So I think your options are they come in for indirect costs, and they don't have a rate, so you term and condition 90 days, and so they have 90 days to develop an indirect cost rate. I'm hearing Keisha say they can get this flat 10%. We're the cognizant agency, so I'm not sure if they would have the third option of if they had a HUD grant, we would apply their rate or not. If it's less than 3 years, that's available to tribes. You know,
well, some nonprofit recipients, EPA is not the cognizant agency for.
Right.
So, the event that we're not the cognizant agency and they have an existing grant with their cognizant agency, we would allow them to provide us a copy of that grant award, provided that the budget period and the award period is the same as the grant that EPA intends to leg.
Yeah, so I've always understood that to be a year, but I don't know if that's expanded in this policy, but we've often accepted that. Those are the only options that I'm aware of, but Keisha, correct me if I'm missing one.
Right. That's exactly what I'm thinking.
So I think we have a not clear, because from what I understand in the past, that was an option. And
I think you're confusing direct costs with indirect costs. So those are the options for indirect costs. Now, if you have direct costs, they can petition to do an amendment to do budget line item adjustments within the direct costs. For, again, say, for instance, they budgeted for travel, and then they decided that they weren't going to take that travel, but then they needed to use those funds to cover salaries. It's possible that they could ask that they can rebudget that to cover salaries, like if they hired a new person or whatever.
Keisha?
Yes.
We need to move this along, so
okay.
Maybe you and Kathleen can have a sidebar discussion at another time.
Okay.
Yeah, because I know you want to get to touch base on your IGMS grantee data compliance slides. So that's part of your presentation, so I just want to make sure you have enough time to get to it.
Okay.
Okay.
Were there any other questions?
The other question was for Kathleen. And it's from Debbie Lowe, and it reads, in the additional resources section, there is a document called draft terms and conditions. Will there be a final version developed for this year's CARE Award?
The draft terms and conditions is actually draft because each region is a little different, and everything that is in that document is kind of it's up for negotiation regarding what each region wants to put in it, but there's a lot of great information in there that you and your grant specialist may want to consider finalizing. There may be additional things that your grant specialist in your region requires, and I don't have access to all of that, so it will continue to be draft, and it's just a kind of a baseline foundational document to use as needed in each region.
Okay, thank you, Kathleen. Okay, Keisha.
Okay, so I think this is the very last slide, so we should be on slide number 64. And, again, we just want to reiterate that, you know, you can always ask questions, you know, make it a point to communicate both with your grant specialist as well as the recipient. You want to set the bar so that the recipient knows exactly what you expect of them in terms of performance and meeting the goals of the grant. We want to be a partner with our recipients, and then most of all, we want you to have fun. So if there are no other questions, we can move to the presentation on the IGMS grantee compliance database.
There are no other questions?
There are no online questions. Does anyone have questions from the phone? Okay, Keisha.
Okay. So, as I said in the beginning of the Grants, Do's, and Don'ts presentation, we are looking to build better working relationships with the project officers. Especially being here in headquarters, we don't get a chance to interface with a lot of the project officers face-to-face. So the Grantee Compliance Database is one way that we can communicate, all of us can communicate, the compliance folks, the grant specialists, the project officers. If you turn to the next slide. What is the Grantee Compliance Database? The database is actually a repository of information about the recipients. It's actually where we, the compliance team, as well as grant specialists and the programs, can actually store information about the recipient. And because we've been under a lot of scrutiny and because we're in the age of transparency, it is very important for all of us to use the database because this is how we can, you know, put information in on what's going on with the recipient. The database is actually a place where the programs or the project officers can upload their programmatic advanced monitoring reviews. And once those reports are updated, the compliance team is actually responsible for validating those reports to make sure that you guys get credit for the quarterly performance measures, which I think your target is you guys have to do advanced monitoring on at least 10% of your active recipients for the year. So this is the database that you would use to actually upload any of those reports or any additional information that you want to store to let everyone know what's going on with a particular recipient. And again, it's definitely the method that we use to communicate between the compliance team, project officers, and grant specialists, especially for administrative compliance issues with the recipient. The next slide. You all should have access to the IGMS compliance database. However, if you don't, you can definitely contact the IGMS help desk to get access. You know, once you're in the system, the IGMS compliance database is going to be the little rainbow. So on this slide, it's the little square thingy that's circled in red. But if you don't have access to it, you can definitely contact the hotline, and I've listed their telephone number on this particular slide. If you have additional questions, again, feel free to contact me from the compliance team, and I can make sure that you get it also. So if you actually click on the rainbow, when you click on it and it opens up, the first screen is you're going to see is the screen that appears on this next slide, which is slide 68. And as you can see in the left-hand column, it says IGMS compliance and recipient summary on the side. As long as you're seeing that, then you're okay. And the items that are circled in red are items that you want to pay particularly attention to. I think the recipient summary is the best view for finding recipients. So if you're in the database and you're actually searching for a particular recipient, it's best to click on recipient summary. There are other ways that you can actually sort it, but I think as an initial search, it's best to search under recipient summary. You can also see at the top what's highlighted across the toolbar there. There's add programmatic report. You would click to add an administrative report, but that's what the grant specialist would do. There's also a tab where we can add information about pre-award certification, and as it goes further down, there's a tab for indirect cost information. So, again, this is definitely the repository of information that's related to the grantee. And one of the reasons why we're stressing the use of the IGMS compliance database at this point is because we're seeing with the amount of IG audits that are going on, especially with the AIR reviews or the AIR grant recipients, as well as some of the regular recipients, there are a lot of findings that come out as a result of the IG audits. There have been instances where, I'll just use this as an example, a recipient received a grant from Region 10, and there were some issues with that particular grant award, and it's noted in the database that they had some issues. It could be, you know, commingling funds, or it could be the fact that they didn't have indirect cost rates, so there was an audit, and those costs were actually questioned. But then another region, without looking in the database, actually awarded the recipient an additional grant.
So to the recipient, we're just one EPA. It doesn't matter to them that they got money from one region versus another region, but we want to make sure that we're being consistent and we tell the same story across the board. So it's very important to put information as you get it in the database. There's often entries in the database that says that this recipient can't receive an award until they've actually gone through the pre-award process for, you know, some particular reason. Maybe there were some issues with their organizational structure and they had transactions that were less than arm's length, or they had a conflict of interest where the executive director of one company actually entered into a contract with another company that he also sits on the board with. All of that information would be stored in the database. And so we just want to impress upon you to kind of look just to make sure your recipient is okay and that there are no other outstanding issues with the recipient, or at least to find out what's going on with your recipient during every phase of the grant award process. So if you're looking at this screen, you can do a search. Now, this list is actually in alphabetical order, but the reason why you see National Association of Mongolian Agricultural Cooperatives as the first is because when it was put in the public address book, there's actually a space or two in front of the N, so it's not recognizing, it's recognizing that as a character, and so that's why it's at the top. So if you wanted to search for a recipient, and you put and you uploaded a report, like if you just started typing and you wanted to upload a report and you hit add programmatic report, if you're not actually on the recipient that you were looking for, it's going to add that report under the National Association of Mongolians. And I can tell you they probably have about 2,000 entries because people have entered reports under the wrong recipient. So I think you should go to the next slide, and you want to make sure that when you're in the database, you're on the recipient that you actually want to add a report to. So if you go to the next slide, you can, if you do, if you click on the view bar and you do search this view, it'll actually give you, I guess, a longer list of the recipients, because there are recipients that are entered in the database more than one time. So you want to make sure you go in first to click search this view. But once you've done that, go to the next slide, you'll see in the search bar, this is where you could search for your recipient. In this case, we were doing a search for the University of Nevada. And you can see where the circle is at the top that once we put that in, there were 23 entries that matched that. Because recipients are actually entered into the PAB by different folks in different regions, there, again, there's always going to exist a possibility that your recipient is in here more than one time. One way to differentiate the recipients could be by the DUNS number or by their actual physical address. But again, in looking in the system, you just want to make sure that you're on the recipient that you actually intend to upload the report for. And if you can also look on the screen, there's some little green little twisties that are there. If you click on the twisty, it'll let you know if there's – well, the twisty is an indication that there are other reports or entries that have made under that recipient. So if you look at the top under the Board of Regents, there isn't a twisty because there's nothing that's been entered into the database besides their original screen. But the one under it, there's a twisty, and you can see there was one programmatic report that was added. You can go to the next slide. This is an example of a search for the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. And as I said before, recipients are often in the database more times under different recipient names. Well, the names are the same, but they look different. So in this case, it could be under Georgia spelled out, or it could be under GA, which you can see. So in this example, there's a total of 41 entries for the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. I know it's a little quirky, and we're still working out some of the quirks with IGMS, but, you know, for now, we'll have to bear with the system. We thought we were going to get a new system, but we're told that we're not, so IGMS is definitely going to be around for a while. So, again, you want to make sure that you're on the right recipient. So once you search for your recipient, you can click on it, and then if you want to see if there's a report related to your recipient, then you would click on the little green twisty thing. If you look at the square at the bottom, you can see at least that this recipient has had several programmatic reviews. It's kind of cut off, so there's probably some more entries in there, but you can see
and it under the that summary view, it'll show you the grant number. It'll tell you the type of report, which in this case was a programmatic report. It'll also give you the activity date. And on the far right of the screen, it'll also tell you who actually created the entry. Are there any questions at this point?
I do have a question. This is Tiana Blunt in Region 3. So okay. For this example, you're saying, because I'm looking at the DUNS number for the Georgia Department, there, some of them are the same. And so is that, I mean, so like if we're looking for this particular recipient, we would have to review all of those that have the same DUNS number, because does that mean it's the same program or same recipient?
So the compliance team actually kind of manages the database, so we're not the only people that enter information in the database. So a lot of times what happens is people create entries without verifying whether or not a recipient already exists. In the case of the Georgia Department of Natural Resources, if you look on the left-hand column, so to speak, you can see it, all of them start out with GADNR, but then it looks like they're different programs that may have received in a grant. So it looks like it says EPD or LPD, MSP. Those are the different programs that fall under the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. So in the instance where the DUNS number is the same, it's actually the same organization. It's just that when they entered in the recipient in the database, they did it by the programs under the organization instead of just leaving it as the, or listing it as the department, Georgia Department of Natural Resources. Does that kind of make sense?
Yes. So you need to know your specific, the specific program that you're looking for.
No, you don't have to put it under the program. To us, it's all the same when we're looking for it. So we know that if we're looking for something, we're going to just look under all of them. But for you, like say, for instance, you have a grant now and you want to enter it in under Georgia Department of Natural Resources. Because it's listed here and it has all of these programs, if the grant that you have fits under one of these programs, put it under the program that's listed here. But when we're looking at it, these are grants that are for Georgia Department of Natural Resources. I think it's in here this way because of the way that people put it, but as long as the DUNS number is the same, you're going to be okay.
Okay, thank you.
And so in terms of you uploading your programmatic reports, we don't actually go through the database to look at every recipient to determine whether or not you've actually loaded the report. We have another search view that we use, so we'll be able to catch anything that you put in the system. So it's not like your report won't get overlooked. It'll definitely get reviewed and validated. But for you, in terms of your inputting data, if you have a grant that's related to the Georgia Department of Natural Resources and is related to one of the particular programs that's already listed, by all means, just put it under that program. We have started some cleanup efforts where we've tried to kind of truncate some of the entries that are in, but it's pretty much when we have downtime, so it's definitely not perfect. It's nowhere near perfect now.
So, Keisha, this is Kathleen.
Yes.
I have a question.
Okay.
Under the IGMS system at the region for the particular grant, so it has its own, like, award number and where the award is, where the work plan is, et cetera. That's different than this system. So, for instance, if we're putting in that system for the individual grant, all of our programmatic reviews, is that not then captured in the system that you're discussing?
You are absolutely right. It's a totally different system. The IGMS compliance database is recipient-based. It's not grant-based. So any information you put in the other system is not going to automatically transfer over to the compliance database. Because we now know that IGMS is going to stick around for a lot longer, we're actually compiling a list of suggested upgrades, so to speak, and we have that as on the list. It would be very nice and helpful for all of us if the systems talk together. Right now, they don't.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's an online question from April in Region 8.
Okay.
So I should be entering my quarterly reports on ESC and also in IGMS. I was informed by my RC and other POs that ESC is the only place for our reporting. Is this new? Should I be doing this from here on out?
Your quarterly reports or your programmatic reviews?
Go ahead, Keisha. I'm sorry.
So the programmatic reviews, the ones that you get credit for to meet your 10% target, those should be uploaded in the IGMS compliance database. That's where the validation takes place. But your other quarterly reports that you do for your recipient, you can definitely just keep them in the other system.
Okay, thanks. Because the ESP is our system to capturing everything we're doing.
Right.
But wait a minute, as a project officer, you're posting them in the ESC for the CARE program, but you're also posting them in IGMS as part of your baseline monitoring, right?
That's not what she said, though. What you said, Keisha, was that the baseline monitoring is what you put in IGMS, right?
No. I said the programmatic reviews. I'm not talking. These are programmatic reviews are reports that you guys do as part of your performance measures. Baseline monitoring is done in a totally different system.
So when you say programmatic reviews, right? Every quarter we have a template that we use, and we call it the Project Officer Quarterly Review for the CARE program. Is that programmatic review is the same thing you're talking about?
The programmatic reviews that I'm speaking of is you guys are required to do advanced monitoring on your grant recipients. And I think this is done on an annual basis. And so once that review is completed, we're asking you to upload it in the compliance database. And then someone from the compliance team will actually validate that report. And then that's how you guys get credit for meeting your target.
So this is about if you're selected.
Wait a minute. One at a time. I think Maggie was talking. And then you, Kathleen.
So this is, there's two types of post-award monitoring. We call them, it's like an audit. One is programmatic, it's advanced programmatic, and one is administrative. The programmatic, and generally the region decides, like the temp, you have to have 10% of all your grants have to have this advanced programmatic monitoring. And so CARE grants may be selected for this. And so as a project officer, you lead this process, and then it results in a report. And so the place for you to post that report, which is the report of the advanced programmatic monitoring / audit, is this grants compliance database. If you had an advanced administrative that's selected, nationally, and you get one of those wonderful audits that OGD pays the big bucks for, those are also posted. Say your recipient had a corrective measure and they have to respond back in so many days. That gets posted in the compliance database, too. Your quarterly reports, which is part of just what you're monitoring under your grant, that does not get posted here. That gets posted in the Environmental Science Connector for the CARE program. It gets posted in, as part of your, in IGMS, as part of your ongoing baseline monitoring of your grant. So I hope I answered that. Aloha.
Yeah, and I think Kathleen was trying to get in, and maybe I cut her off. Were you trying to get in, Kathleen?
No, that wasn't me.
Okay. Was anybody else trying to get in? Okay.
That wasn't me trying to get in, but I do have a question. This is Tiana. And so essentially, we just need to find out if CARE, for our region, if CARE is part of that 10% that requires this advanced monitoring, correct?
Yeah, and I will tell you how it works in our region. The managers nominate 10% in their division, okay? So this is how we've been nominated. Our director has nominated us as part of this 10%. There's criteria, and since we award larger grants, oftentimes this is one of the reasons why we're nominated, okay? Then the GMO reviews that, and if they concur, they make the list. And then the GMO sends the list out to all the grant managers and project officers if you're selected. That's how in our region it works. I assume it works similar in other regions.
Yeah, it's the same. You're right.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
So, Tiana, if your director nominates you for programmatic, you're selected. You're going to probably get selected.
Yeah, but remember, it's an advanced programmatic review. We're not talking about the quarterly reports that you guys do.
Right.
Your advanced monitoring. reviews. And so, as she mentioned, recipients have both advanced programmatic reviews that we do, or that the agency does, and then they also have advanced administrative monitoring reports. And so what we're saying is that we need you guys to make sure that you're uploading those documents in the database so that we can validate them. And, you know, we want to make sure that you guys are using the database to identify other issues that might be related to your recipient.
And this is Tana. I have one more question. Do you all know, because I do recall this, I'm also appeal for non-point source, and we're not actually included in that, but I do recall hearing about this in an appeal form. But do you know, is this change, does the 10% or whoever is included in that 10%, does that change from year to year, or like how does it, is it something that we need to just kind of keep checking on?
Yeah, every year this process goes on. 10% your management's identifying, 10% of its grants in your division for advanced programmatic monitoring. Also, the headquarters and the GMO are identifying for advanced administrative. You could get selected for both, potentially. West Michigan was selected for both, but they aren't necessarily done concurrently. So every year they're selecting a new set of grants. So we were having a conversation earlier before it gets discussed here, and I said, hey, did Gary in Detroit get selected this year? No. Okay, you're probably going to get selected next year. Because of the large amount that CARE grants are, you know, chances are sometime in the life, especially if you're level two, you're going to get selected.
And actually, in Region 1, our grants are selected just randomly. Out of all the grants that we oversee here in the region. So,
for programmatic, yeah. Some regions do that. Pick the 10% programmatic is sometimes, but usually it's done at the division level, too. Like our region for 1 year, and my division did that. They're given an option. There's a criteria for being selected, but every year you want to know if you were selected.
Maggie?
Yeah?
Can you please call April offline? She needs some more clarity. April,
can absolutely. Thank you.
Sharon has made a comment, and her comment says that in Region 6, the branch managers decide on which grants are selected for advanced monitoring.
Yeah, the director signs off on it, but usually whoever your grant branch person is nominating you.
Kathleen has a comment up online. One of the attendees had suggested that the CARE program create an understandable chart for reporting requirements.
So that could be something that we work on so that this is clear on where you report each aspect of all of our reporting requirements, because it is a bit overwhelming. And I don't think that would be very difficult to do, so we could work on that as a team.
Kathleen, this is Keisha. I can help you with that, or at least I can give you the programmatic requirements that we have in terms of reporting from on the grant side, at least where we need you guys to report as far as the grantee compliance database is concerned.
Great.
So we can definitely work together on that. I can get you something so you won't have to reinvent the wheel.
Oh, yay. Thank you.
And so, again, the target doesn't change. It's 10% every year, but the grant that gets reviewed will probably change. So on the administrative side, our reviews are done by recipient. They're not grant-specific. They're recipient. And so during our review process, we're actually reviewing any active grant that the recipient has at that particular time. But from the programmatic advanced monitoring standpoint, it's a review of a particular grant. But again, the target doesn't change. It's always going to be 10% of the active awards that the programs have, you know, for that year. I think my presentation is almost over, but if you click to the next slide, I can go over this really quickly. And then if there are additional questions, you can contact me directly, and I'll be more than happy to go over them with you. So on the next slide, which should be slide number 72, this is actually the summary page of the recipient once you've identified the recipient that you're actually looking for. So again, in this case, it's the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. And on the recipient summary page, there's a lot of information about the recipient. Another way that you can determine if you have the right recipient is to kind of match up the address, the physical location of the recipient to the one that you're looking for. The circle that's highlighted in the middle on the screen, there's also information about the number of active awards the recipient has versus the total number of awards that they've actually received. And it's highlighted because you can actually click into either one of those areas and it will take you to the electronic grant file. And there's additional information, including a copy of the entire electronic version of the grant award in that particular system. And so this system does link to the EGF. At the bottom, in that little box at the bottom, that's just the summary of the active grants that the recipient has. It tells you the grant number, the title of the grant, the grant specialist. It also lists the project officer and the award date. However, you can't click in this. This is just so you can see at an eyeball glance the active grants and, you know, from what program they're from. And really quickly, if you click on the next screen, there's a list of programmatic reports, and these are, like, the reports, again, that are done on specific grants. But once you click in that particular item, there'll be information about the actual review that was conducted. So if you look a little down at the bottom, there's a button that lets you choose the type of activity you're performing. In this case, it was a programmatic on-site, but as you can see by the drop-down, there's other choices. It could be a programmatic desk review, a programmatic technical assistance, programmatic enforcement, like if you guys had some type of enforcement issue and you wanted to upload that information in database, and you would choose that as an option. Also, where you see the little PDF, there's a file that was attached, and that's actually a copy of the programmatic review of the report that was done for this particular grant. If you type in the grant number where the second circle appears, that field will automatically populate the project description, provided you don't have your program code. So all you need is the actual grant number. And then once you click in your grant number, the project description will automatically fill in. And then there are other questions about, like the program synopsis that you'll have to answer yes or no. And you can see the results of that on the following page. For the most part, it's an easy system to kind of navigate. Again, if you have any questions, you can give me a call. There's a couple of more slides after this, but I think they're probably self-explanatory. So I can take a couple of questions now unless we have to move on.
Yes, Keisha, we are like 5 minutes behind.
Okay.
So we can take one question if we have one question. There are no online questions, so is anyone on the phone? Have a question for Keisha? Okay, if not, we'll move on to Marketing Care by Tiana Blunt.
Okay. And I'm going to be quick. So, good afternoon. My name is Tiana Blunt, Region 3 Coordinator for Care, and just wanted to quickly go over some marketing tips, sharing care stories, results, and promising practices. And so you can move to the next slide. And just I will be covering the importance of marketing, types of marketing, marketing tips and questions, and then at the end I'll go over CARES, one of CARES marketing tools, which is a promising practice document or publication. And so starting with the importance of marketing, I separated this actually into external and internal benefits. And when I say external, I mean more so focused for the grantee. And because CARE is a community-driven program, of course, one of the benefits would be community involvement. So the importance of getting your story out is the more people know about it, of course, the more people are going to want to be involved and want to be engaged. Community exposure, which leads to increased partnerships and financial support. Again, the stronger your story is, the stronger your marketing methodology is, the more input and involvement you're going to get. And because one of our goals for the program is to sustain, for the grantees to sustain themselves after the EPA financial support has concluded, it's important to have a strong story so that you can kind of leverage that, whether it's financial support or more partners after the grant is over.
And for internal purposes, of course, it's great to have a strong story so that as project officers and regional coordinators, we can reach out to other programs, other divisions for technical support. So it's much easier if they've heard about CARE and seen our success to ask them and not have to, you know, tell them our story from the beginning, because they will already be aware of CARE, and so they'll be more than happy to assist us. Also, we can leverage our story for financial support from other programs. Again, just the more exposure we get as a program, the more support we can get, and the more involvement, you know, other communities will hear about us, other programs will let their grantees know that this is the opportunity that they can take advantage of, and increase partnerships and future sustainability, which will in turn help the grantees as well. And so the next slide, I'm just going over the types of marketing. And you have, of course, your public events that can vary anywhere from big check ceremonies where, you know, the regional administrator may be present, to community meetings, just anything that as a grantee you can get people, get the story out about what you're doing in the community, what the purpose of the program is, and what the purpose of the event is. And then you also have media, so you have radio, TV, internet. You know, now it's a huge era of social media, so you have Facebook and Twitter, blogs, all of these different venues in which you can get your message out and get your story out about CARE. And then you have, of course, your materials, which can lead anywhere from signs to pamphlets that you can distribute throughout your communities, or publications such as the one EPA CARE program has created, which is the Promising Practice publication. And, okay, going to the next slide, discussing marketing tips. And I always, I wanted to start with the grantees because, again, this is a community-driven program, and I was speaking to Maggie, and she gave me this wonderful sentence, which I want to turn into a quote, and she didn't even realize it. And she said, if it's not led by the grantee, then reconsider. And I think that's a really great tip to use when you're considering marketing, because this is a program that we want the grantees and the community to really take the lead on, and not kind of as project officers or regional coordinators and EPA kind of say, this is what we want, this is how you should do it, this is how you should market. We really want it to be led by the community, and so these are some of the things that grantees should consider as marketing tips. Be able to specify outcomes. Excuse me. Be able to specify outcomes by quantifying your measures, so reductions in pollutions or policy changes, really be able to tell that story. You want to be able to explain how the community has built capacity for future action, and emphasize leveraging methods. And I thought this was a really good point, because not only do we use marketing to kind of get our stories out there and get involvement, but this is a great opportunity for other communities to kind of see what we're doing, what has worked for our communities, what has worked as for our program, so that they can kind of take these tips and learn from them and also use them in their communities. The next one is use innovative approaches to get results. And this is really important because different communities are set up differently. You may have one community that has a younger population. So, of course, you don't want to post flyers or things like that because your story is not going to get out that way. You may want to approach it by using the social media, Twitter or Facebook, because that's what's going to be more successful in getting your story out, versus if you have a community that's more built around a faith-based organization, you can go through them through posting and maybe in their bulletin. You know, maybe that's a successful way of getting your message out. And then the last thing, of course, is to present in a manner that's easily, quickly digestible to your audience. You don't want something that's weighed down with technical language or just so short, so long that, you know, you're no longer able to keep people's attention. You want something that's quick and simple, but explanatory, so that they're engaged and wanting to find out more and wanting to get involved in your practice. and go into the next slide. This is marketing tips for the project officers and regional coordinators. Again, encourage community-driven marketing. So this is both internally and externally. Make sure that your community is involved. And if you're doing something internally to get the message out about care or to get a message out about a particular community, make sure that community is involved. If you've developed a document, you know, just shoot them an email or give them a call and say, hey, I'm getting ready to kind of distribute this document just to engage my region. I wanted to make sure that you're okay with the message that I'm going to send out, and make sure that they're just involved in whatever message that you're sending or about their community, especially if you're using it within EPA. And then, of course, externally, we want to encourage that they determine what marketing they're going to do. The next one is ensuring that the grantee includes marketing in the work plan. This budget, this is allowed, and this is something that should be done when we're negotiating the work plan. And the third piece is working with the Regional Public Affairs Office. Working with the Regional Public Affairs Office and Communication Officer. Each region, I'm sure, is set up differently as to the process to go through and to do a public event or to have regional or EPA involvement in a public event. I know for Region 3, each division has a communication officer assigned. We contact them even if we have an idea or a thought that we may have some kind of event that we want to be involved in. And then from there, they actually contact upper management if it's something that we want the RA to be involved in or upper management to be involved in. They are the ones who actually make those contacts and check the availability and those types of things. So it's not the project officer or the regional coordinator going straight to the RA saying, hey, we're going to have this big check event. Come on down. So that's something that you need to be familiar with so you know the protocol to take. And that leads to the proper use of EPA logo. And in this presentation, this link actually hyperlinks to the page. So if you go to, I believe if you go to the additional resources, you can download this actual presentation and you can go to the link through this highlighted section. But it just mentions, it just talks about how the proper uses of EPA logo, you can't add to it or remove anything from it. And any outside agencies or organization has to get permission from the Office of Public Affairs before they even use the logo. So if your grantee is thinking about doing an event and wants to provide that EPA logo, you want to be sure that you're going through the proper chains within your region to get that to get the use of the logo permitted. And then the last piece that project officers and regional coordinators should consider is utilizing the event checklist if you're doing a public event or a regional administrator's event. Again, this document is available in the additional resources as an attachment, and it really just goes through all the things that you want to kind of make sure that you have completed or that you're considering when you're planning this event. So it's an agenda. Do you have how is your room going to be set up? Different, what materials are you going to use? Do you need audio equipment? Is this an internal or external event? So it just really kind of walks you through the process. And you can access that, like I said, in the additional resources page. So going to the next slide, this just discusses marketing questions. And another quote that I wanted to use here is, you know, a great way to start a project is starting it with knowing the end, with keeping the end in mind. And so even as you're negotiating or working with the grantee, developing the work plan, you know, you want to already have in mind the story you want to tell. Or at the end, you know, what are the highlights that you want to be able to pull out? And so these are just some of the questions that will really help in developing strong marketing. And some of the questions are, what will we be able to say about our accomplishments? What are the measures of success? How did care change the community, which I think is a big thing. How, what's the story from beginning to end? A lot of times, with the marketing, communities are able to not only share their story, but I think a lot of times people want to see, okay, well, how has the community changed? And I think if you have a strong story, people are going to be even more willing to be engaged because they see that you've actually done something. And if you go to the next slide, we're going to talk briefly about the Promising Practices publication, which is one of the EPA's care programs, way to meet both the needs of marketing and promoting peer-to-peer learning. And the purpose of this publication is to essentially inspire, inform, and motivate other communities who are facing environmental health risk. Each one of the stories, and there's 14, really illustrate collaboration, inclusion, and the different risks that have been taken. And, you know, the lessons that have been learned, each story kind of starts with key actions and follows and concludes with project results. So you're really able to see what the communities began with, what were the initial issues, and, you know, what their ultimate results were. And so I think it's a great tool that other communities can kind of reference and see how communities before them have been successful in addressing their multimedia issues. And if you go to the next slide, the publication was so successful that EPA is actually underway of developing a second edition. And at this point, all regions are developing at least one two-page story with just a focus on articulating quantifiable results and, again, just telling the care story. And so going to the next slide is just an example of one of the care communities that were highlighted in the document, and this one is the New Haven community. It had multimedia issues, land use, air, water concerns, and they wanted to develop a comprehensive plan that addressed everything succinctly. They used care funding to hire an environmental engineer to address these initiatives and found that air emissions, were one of the prioritized issues. So you can see here in the results box that was provided how they addressed some of these air issues. You know, they retrofitted some of 150 vehicles and 300 school buses to address the diesel emissions. They installed wind turbines and built bike paths to encourage the use of more eco-friendly modes of transportation. And then if you go to the next slide, again, it's just information that was provided to give an overview of the community. They used environmental sustainability actually affected change in policies. And so, again, just showing that an example with this publication that other communities can kind of come in and relate to this story if they have air emission issues and they can kind of see, okay, what did this community do to address their issue and take that and use that within their communities, which I think is very effective. And so going to the last slide, just again, we talked about the importance of marketing, types of marketing, covered different tips and questions you can use when addressing your marketing, and then we went over the promising practices, and I know I'm at my 3:30 time limit, so unless there's questions or other people on the line that may want to share stories about their marketing experience, I'm all done.
And you did a great job, too.
You did. Thank you.
We're very proud of you, Tiana. Awesome.
We are.
So, any questions for Tiana?
I have a question. Where is that checklist?
It is on the wherever the additional resources or attachments.
Yeah, I believe
it's the last one.
It's next to the last.
Next to last.
the checklist for public events.
Yes, next to the last one.
And then there's also, and I forgot to mention this, there's also, I think the last one is the, there's a big check template. And so it's, if you have a big check event that you can use that check, I think it prints out a pretty large check. And that's also, in that section.
So great job.
Mm-hmm.
And we're finishing on time. Katrisa, do you want to?
Well, no, I'm just going to open it up and say if we don't have any more questions for Tiana, I don't know if anyone has questions for any of the other presenters, and if you do, this is the time to pose your question before we wrap up. We'll hand it over to Michael Adam. Michael, are you still on the line with us?
Yes,
okay. So we'll wrap up with some questions, and then we'll turn it over to you, Michael, to go over the very last slide.
Yeah, well, Stacey, this is Marva. Stacey, I didn't know if you wanted to say some closing remarks or talk about how you felt about the session or what worked for you, and I think we want to open it up to other people to see if this worked well for them.
Exactly. Just really wanted to, I thought it overall went extremely well for our first webinar, but really wanted to hear back from those of you who participated on from the regions on how useful was this particular training and using this particular a webinar, how did that work for you all? Any immediate kind of thoughts on that? I know that there's a feedback form that Michael's going to talk about, but is there anything anyone would like to say or share at this point?
This is Terry in Region 9. I just want to say I think you all did a really great job. As usual, the information that you're presenting is just—it's just wonderful. It's just, you know, since the beginning, it's every year it gets more clear, and it's just—it's really—it's really really great. I today just looked at the slides and listened to you. I miss seeing you, and so that would be something I'll look forward to the next one we do in a couple next week or the week after. But in any case. I think that what would be useful is now is to follow up like with the PO conference calls. I think they're very very valuable, and to bring up the topics I guess that are most on people's minds, or if I don't know, just go through the process again. It takes a while to really come to grips with some of this information. There are so many different things to do, but I think you all did a really great job. Thank you very much.
Maggie, I think Hi. It was awesome, too. I would also like to say on behalf of David and Region 5, we're going to be hosting the August PO call, and we would love to know what would be a great topic you'd love to hear a follow-up from this training. So just let us know if you think of something.
Okay, April from Region 8 gave 2 comments. Thanks, everyone, for their hard work. This was very informative. The webinar worked well. For FYI, there is a list of those who are on this
simulcast
mm-hmm. on the homepage.
Great. Thanks, April.
Any other comments or suggestions for improvement?
Hi, this is Erin from Region 3. I just wanted to thank all of you for taking the time to put this together. I'm a relatively new PO in general, and then I picked up the CARE grant when it was about 3 months into its award. So this is very helpful for me to kind of get up to speed. And Tiana and I have spoken several times, and looking forward to working with her and with all of you in the future. Thank you.
Great. This is Pam Houston from Region 7. I really enjoyed this class as well. However, I do have one suggestion. I have been in other conferences, video conferences, and conference calls where the leader flips through the slides. That way, everybody's on the same page at the same time. Thank you.
Good comment. And maybe I'll talk with the conference coordinators to see if that's something that can be incorporated through CLUIN to do for the next one. thanks for the comment.
Hi, this is Urbana Region 1. I do have the pleasure of sitting right next to Stacey. I think this was a very comprehensive training, and I'm impressed by the fact that it's hands-on involvement with the grantee and building just not just partnership, but also like additional resources that may or may not be available to the grantee. I think, though, I mean, this wasn't face-to-face because of, you know, budgetary issues and concerns, but I think, you know, getting to see people right in person in front of you is pretty helpful. And I'm hopeful that, you know, as time progresses, we may be able to do some of this training face-to-face. But overall, I learned a lot.
And also, just wanted to just remind folks that our next training date is on the 30th, starting right at 12 o'clock noon. And on the next training, some of the topics we will cover is reporting and measurements with by Michelle Mendoza and care resources and tools, where you learn more about the voluntary programs and the various programmatic resources. And then also, Margaret Millard is going to lead a facilitated kind of session on, we're calling it Ask the Mentor. So this is a great opportunity for the new POs and RCs to talk to some of the seasoned RCs and POs as mentors. And actually, for those of you who are interested in having someone to connect with someone as a mentor, feel free to shoot me an email. And I'll work with the coordinators to see how we can connect you with the right folks. So, again, just want to thank everyone today for just taking out the time. And, again, want to thank Catrice Jefferson for all of her help, and also Margaret and Kathleen and Marva and Gail. I think it was a great effort, and I'm glad to have been able to be a part of it, and look forward to the next training day. So I'll hand it back off to Marva for any other comments.
Yeah, and I was thinking about Kathleen Fenton always says we need to talk about our aha moments. And for me, my aha moment was that that made me very excited is that we stayed on time. I mean, we actually stayed on time. And we didn't know how this was going to work because this is our first time doing a webinar for the PO training. And I really, kudos to all of us. All the presenters, mm-hmm. everyone, as we worked through this and stayed on time. So.
And thank you to Stacey for all of your hard work.
Oh, yeah, Stacey.
Yes. This is Kathleen, and I think there were some really good suggestions about that I picked up about not being there is, you know, a negative, but we could maybe improve that by putting mugshots up there of everybody who is speaking. So we might consider doing that next year or even for the 30th if that's a possibility.
Well, if you have photos that you can send, send them my way and I will submit them to the Cluin folks and they can put them right next to your bio. When you click on your bio, there's a photo. If you click on Marva's bio, there's a photo of Marva. So if you have a photo you want to see, want to attach to your bio, send them my way. This is Catrice.
And Catrice, this is Michelle. And maybe I might do this because I'm going to send you the slides. I'll just put my photo on the front page of my slides.
How about okay.
That? That's a good idea.
That's a good idea, too. Put it on the front page of your mm-hmm. slides. Yeah.
You and Marva are always on the cutting edge, you guys. Way to go.
I do want to see if Gail wanted to say some closing remarks before we hand it over to Michael.
Only to thank everybody for hanging in there for almost 4 hours and for all the hard work of all the presenters. I know it went by quickly. It really, and to say that we really, really appreciate all of the hard work that all of you put in on the CARE program.
And can I give one last thank you? I really would like to thank Michael. Yes. Michael stepped in We were panicking because we really wanted to use Clue-In. We liked the facilitation portion of Clue-In. And Michael just stepped in and said he would assist us. So, Michael, I really, really would like to thank you. And I do apologize again for having to revise a number of the documents that I sent to you, Peter and Jean.
At the last minute.
Yeah, so thank you very much. And we'll turn it over to you to close out for us.
Yeah, that's not a problem, and as to the one question about the technology issue, we can certainly talk about that. Well, I won't get into it here, but we can talk about it in the future. I got two really quick things to wrap things up, and we're going to slide 89, if you're still with us. There's a link there to additional resources that have been talked about through the program. It'll take you back to the seminar page where the links are. And on those pages, there are links to download the resources that were talked about. Secondly, we have a feedback form, and it's linked to on slide 89. It'll pre-populate with the contact information you provided us initially, and we would really appreciate any feedback at all, whether it's technical or our content. That really helps everybody out. So with that, I think it's time to end the seminar. Thanks, everybody.